It's time for Mac Break Weekly, kind of a special episode because it is, after all, our Christmas Day episode. This week, we're going to give you a best of, as we have in years past, some of the best moments from Mac Break 2018. Enjoy.
Netcasts you love.
From people you trust.
This is TWiT.
This is Mac Break Weekly, episode 642, for Christmas Day, Tuesday, December 25th, 2018. Our holiday best of. Mac Break Weekly is brought to you by Calm, the number one app to help you meditate, sleep, and relax. Give yourself the gift of Calm. For a limited time, get 25% off a Calm premium subscription at calm.com/MacBreak. And by Hopsy, the Nespresso, or Keurig, if you will, for beer. And just for the holidays, visit tryhopsy.com/MacBreak and use the promo code MacBreak to get the Sub Home Draft System, two mini kegs of beer, two Hopsy glasses, and a free membership in the monthly beer club, all for only $99. Terms and conditions apply. And by Casper, a sleep brand that continues to revolutionize its line of products to create an exceptionally comfortable sleep experience one night at a time. You can save $50 towards select mattresses by visiting casper.com/MacBreak and using the promo code MacBreak at checkout. Well, hello, everybody. Welcome to a very special episode of Mac Break Weekly. We like to do this once a year. Karsten has worked so very hard to put together what we like to call the best of. What I like to call Daddy's Drinking Time. So we're going to take some time and enjoy some of the past memories. Are these in chronological order?
They are in chronological order.
Okay, so they're in chronological order, starting with the beginning of the year, the mini controversy. You might remember it about the iPhone. Seems Apple was slowing it down. All right, let's talk about batteries, because that was the story that kept poor Rene Ritchie working through the holiday break. I'm sorry. This story broke like Christmas Eve. When did it break?
Yeah, it was. Well, I mean, it never really broke. That was the thing. Like, Apple did this almost a year ago, and then there was a Reddit thread about a guy who replaced his battery and got some attention, and then John Poole from Geekbench ran his benchmarks, and it slowly started gaining ground. It was like a snowball just going downhill towards Christmas.
Yeah. So, but as usual, Reddit is, you know, where you find this stuff. This one, 24 days ago, PSA, iPhone slow, try replacing your battery. And so this one has been updated since the original post. Apple at first didn't say anything. There was just all of this information and then Apple finally said, yeah, they copped to it. Yeah. And they explained why. So I'm going to, rather than paraphrase Apple, I'm going to let you paraphrase Apple. What did Apple, they said, we slow it down. Yeah. Why?
Yeah. So, all right. So what happened was about a year ago, there was this issue where iPhone 6 and some iPhone 6S were draining fast and shutting down or just shutting down even when they had charge. And it was a bit of a brouhaha. And Apple eventually made a comment saying that there was a percentage of people who are having this issue and they were going to make changes to try to prevent it. And it was a bad issue back then because you couldn't even restart the iPhones unless you went and physically plugged them in. They were just off. And so Apple did two things. One, they made it so that the iPhones could reboot without being connected to external power so that they would come back on. And they made a change in iOS 10.3.2. Before that, they did an earlier version of iOS that ran a bunch of diagnostics and tried to figure out what was going wrong, got the information, and then used that to make the update. And what they ended up doing was adding battery health, power management to the throttling mechanism in iOS. And all CPUs are almost always throttled, typically for heat, because if they get too hot, it's incredibly damaging. So the processor will start really fast and then ramp down as the heat builds up inside a device. And iPhones are tiny, tiny little devices. But what this was doing was making sure that as the battery health deteriorated, especially if it was deteriorating quickly due to exposure to heat or exposure to cold or massive amounts of charge cycles, anything like that, it was no longer causing those power spikes, which were causing the device to shut down. So everything sounded fine back then. Apple pushed out the update. Everyone sort of went on with their lives. And then as the devices got a little bit older and the batteries aged a little more, people started seeing profound performance degradation in some of these devices, maybe like by 25% or 33%. And when you're dealing with an iPhone, that's quite a bit, especially because Apple is famous for single-thread performance. It's what makes the interface feel so snappy. And it was not intuitive why it was happening, because if your phone drains or it shuts off, you might suspect the battery and you might take it in and get the battery serviced. But if your phone is slow, you don't suspect the battery at all. So people weren't really – they didn't understand what the problem was. So this threaded thread came out and the guy changed the battery and suddenly everything was great. And John Poole saw it, who runs Geekbench, and his wife's iPhone was slow and he started running all these benchmarks. And it showed that how much certain iPhone models over time were downgrading or throttling the performance in order to maintain – the battery life and prevent the shutdowns. And it wasn't all of them. I think the figures that we're seeing is like 33% of them. But that is, when you're talking about iPhone owners, that is a huge number of devices. So that became big news. And then Apple started, you know, to start putting out statements. Yes, we're doing this, what they called advanced power management, which is throttling on the CPU. And then Leo, it snowballed further.
Well, and part of the problem is that there's always, everyone keeps on saying that Apple's slowing down their phones. So there's a conspiracy theory that's been kind of that this is...
It fits very well what people have been saying for a while, which is Apple wants you to buy a new phone. So when you get iOS 11, your older phone's not going to work as well. And that's just to prod you into getting a new phone. That's not for any technical reason. Now, let's give people a TLDR, because CR1 somebody in the chat room said, I had to explain this to every single family member the whole holiday season. So let me try this, Renee, and see if this represents it fairly. Because batteries in phones age.
All batteries age.
All batteries.
Yes.
And at some point, they won't be able to do the things they used to do. Apple, when in the operating system, checks the battery. If it's an older battery, it will keep the keep programs from doing things that are really taxing to the battery. The choice would be the battery will shut down if it doesn't do this, and that means the phone will shut. So Apple prefers you have a slower phone, as you would probably, a slower phone with an old battery
that still
than
makes
a phone
calls.
That crashes all the time.
Or that still makes phone calls.
And this I learned today, Apple's software checks the battery, and if you put a new battery in,
it immediately gets better.
It immediately will speed up. So it's not that the phone is old, it's that the battery is old.
And it shipped like the iPhone. This only affects iPhone 6, iPhone SE, iPhone 6S, and with iOS 11.2, they're starting to bring iPhone 7 into it as well. If you have an iPhone 5S or earlier, it will still shut down. And this is not unique to Apple. There's reports as of yesterday of Samsung Galaxy Notes shutting down. Well, and there's old stories.
Okay, so this is the second story, which is HTC, LG, Motorola, and Samsung, all Android handset manufacturers said, we don't do this. Which led more fuel to the fire because...
But no, because like if you go back a couple, even like OnePlus earlier this year and several years ago, Anantec and Geekbench caught them never running their CPUs at peak. Only for benchmark apps would they run them at peak. And the reason Samsung gave in their statement was because they didn't want to overload the GPU or the CPU. And that's the same. We have increasingly desktop quality processors in devices that have teeny tiny little phone sized batteries, and you can't balance those things. You only have to make choices about which one you're going to prioritize.
You do, in fact, see this on even laptops. You'll get an i7 on a laptop, but because of thermal issues, you'll never see it run at full speed. It'll always be somewhat slowed down. So this is similar to that.
And iPads will, like iPads, the battery is so big that it doesn't, people have been asking about that a lot. iPads, the battery is so big, the density is so high that it never hit, even when the batteries have to get really, really old before you start seeing any unexpected shutdowns or degradation.
So they don't do this in iPads. They only do this in iPhones.
No. Yeah,
I thought the SE was fairly modern, but I guess it's an iPhone 6S.
It's the iPhone 6S platform. Yeah. So it's the 6, 6S, SE, and now the iPhone 7.
But you wouldn't see this on a brand new SE or an SE that's less than a year or so old. How old does a battery have to be before you start to see this?
Apple will only replace it when it hits 80% capacity, which is the magic number for them. But you might see this when it starts getting to around 85%, which was also part of the problem because Apple Care didn't really understand it. And they were refusing to replace batteries that didn't hit that magic 80% number. even though damage is not always consistent. Like if you put your iPhone on a radiator or leave it out in the heat in Arizona or on an air vent, in a freezing cold New England day, that heat damages that battery far greater than its age might otherwise indicate.
Yes. So Apple got some heat, if so to speak, at first for the conspiracy theory that they were doing this on purpose. Apple's explanation seems to have calmed most people down. But people are still mad at Apple saying you should have communicated this.
Well, people are suing them.
And there's a $999 billion lawsuit against Apple.
I feel really bad about this because Apple did, like, I don't know who was briefed, but Apple did briefings for iOS 10.3.2 and their phone briefings where they sit you down. And Apple's marketing team are incredibly smart. A lot of them have engineering degrees. They really know their products. And they explained the issue and what they were doing to it. And they talked about advanced battery power management. And I never asked what that meant, and I didn't bother to explain it. But there's no magic involved.
They didn't hide it. Nobody asked them.
Well, they should have expressly said we are doing exactly A, B, C, D in order to fix. But the term they used was advanced, and I know what power management is because they throttle for thermals, and I understand basically how the system works. And it never occurred. They never explained it. I never asked.
Yeah.
And a year later, I feel like a complete moron. And it's not entirely on me, but I do feel my responsibility.
No, that's totally beside the point. It's like I just last month or the month before, my MacBook battery started to die, and I got a warning from the operating system saying, "Hey, your battery is starting to become really, really unhealthy." Followed by, "Hey, your battery is definitely broken. You definitely need to get it replaced right now." So there's we have to wonder what Apple's excuse was for not putting up some sort of a dialogue or some sort of a checkbox at some point saying, "Hey, I noticed that your battery is really, really old. I think you're going to want to take it, get the battery replaced soon. Also making sure people know that if you go to the Apple store, they'll charge you only about like $99 out of warranties, $79 or something when it's closer to warranty. Or at least just inform people that this is what's going on and this is what we're going to do to make your experience better." And that people would have liked that, as opposed to all the people that in the past year have come to me saying, "Hey, my battery, for some reason, my phone is really, really slow all of a sudden. I don't know why that's happened." And people leaping to the conclusion that Apple has intentionally slowed down my phone because they want to get me to buy a new one. At which point, I have to explain to them that Apple is really, really good at making you make an emotional decision to buy a new phone without crippling your old one. I mean, this was clearly a problem over the past year and was something that as simple as tell the pilot the status of their aircraft at all times. There's no reason for Apple to have hidden this from the user. So it doesn't matter whether Apple should have briefed the press or briefed other people about what was happening last year. You tell the user that I'm going to make your phone go really slow right now, and this is why I'm making that happen. And if worse comes to worse, if you would rather just have the phone die at 40%, that's up to you. But here's what's happening with your phone and what we want to do about it.
So there was a problem with this. So there was a dialogue. Apple did put it into the battery settings, but it wasn't a pop-up. You had to go look for it. And also, it seems to be triggered way too late in the cycle. Like, you seem to be down throttled well before that dialogue. I was actually talking to John Poole on a podcast. And he's like, "I never got a dialogue." And there it is.
He saw it. How funny.
Yeah.
How funny.
Which was much later than when he ran all his tests, which isn't really helpful to him.
Right.
And I think it almost would have been better if Apple let your phone fail once. You absolutely understand the problem. And then when it came up, it said your iPhone shut down unexpectedly. We can manage this so it won't happen again, but you will have reduced performance. Do you want to do that or do you want to make a genius appointment?
And I think a lot of times, Apple works pretty hard at not having people have to make decisions.
If Apple fails in communication, it's always that.
Yeah, it's always we'll do it for you.
You don't need to know this. We're just going to handle it. And they're right. 99% of people wouldn't notice, except for all the news stories.
Right.
And it fits in with a conspiracy theory.
But I had
I think they did the right thing, though, because now they've announced, final point in the story, that they're going to offer battery upgrades for $50 off, $29.
$29 is great.
It's nothing.
Yeah.
What's the criterion for that? Do you have to prove that it's 85% or 80%?
No, so 80% was the old criteria, but it's my understanding, and I think Apple's going to talk about this later today, it's my understanding that, or they gave MacRumors maybe a comment about it already, they're going to They started doing it way before they originally said. They originally said they were going to do it mid-January because they wanted time to ramp up supply. But they said they're going to start doing it now, and they'll ramp up as they go. And apparently they're not going to worry about the diagnostics. Like, maybe if you bring a brand new phone in, they'll say, dude, this is a brand new phone. It's 100%. You don't need a replacement. But if your phone is anywhere on the – has any sort of significant wear to it, I think they're just going to replace it. No questions asked.
Your review, or you call it an unreview, of the HomePod emerged today, along with Neelai Patel and Joanna Stern. Joanna likened it to the bottom half of a sesame bagel compared to a everything bagel.
She only knows New York bagels, Leo, so that can be forgiven.
Not Montreal bagels, not the same.
No, see, I have my little friend here.
I think, yeah. Oh, you got it. You've had it for a week when you wrote the review.
Almost a week, yeah.
So one thing I learned from Neelai Patel's article is that Apple has a materials department, a soft materials department that made the wrapper for the HomePod.
The acoustically transparent cloth mesh.
And there's a cloth cord even.
Yeah, I can hold it up. I hope this is more resilient than the Lightning cords and the MagSafe cords, because then I'll want it everywhere.
I know. It's really beautiful. Yeah. It's hardwired, though, into the back of the HomePod. Oh, that's too bad.
Yeah. So you can't just buy it here and flip it to South African power.
I have no idea what you're talking about, Renee.
Yeah,
that's the rubber cord.
Standards for cords are wonderful.
Did your hamster get to that? What the heck?
No, just life. Atmosphere, air got to it.
It was a hard winter in Boston land, Leo, and Andy had to struggle to survive.
So my, summary of the reviews I've read so far, including yours, Renee, is it sounds really good.
It sounds really good.
Yeah.
Yeah, no, it really does. There's a lot of technology here. And you think that, Apple's not a speaker company, but they've been slowly and quietly accumulating a ton of speaker talent over the last few years. And they've added all their computational talent, the same thing that let them make portrait mode on iPhone, let them do this acoustic modeling in rooms and build out this system. And they said this project has been going on for 6 years. Neelai and myself and some other people got to tour their giant secret sound lab, which was astonishing in its size and the tools and stuff they had there. And they deliberately created it to be able to make a 3D sound stage just from one speaker. And it really punches above its weight. It's pretty cool to listen to.
So was this why you were in Cupertino? Was for this tour? Yeah. So you and Jim Dalrymple has the article and pictures on the loop of it. So tell us about this. This is the anechoic chamber that they use to test. And of course, every speaker company has one of these.
I went in with some other analysts who had done those kind of tours before, and they said it was very similar, although it was on a scale that they'd never seen before. Like, there were more rooms, and those rooms were bigger and had more stuff in them. Yeah. And I think that's what happens when you have Apple's budget.
Yeah, as we'll learn later in the show, Apple is on a scale that no other company is on.
Yeah,
on
no, totally. And so there was one room that it was a room within a room that was being suspended, and there was a wire mesh floor that you're not allowed to jump on as a trampoline. I learned that very quickly. And it has just cardboard acoustic. Sometimes there was cardboard acoustic tiling. Sometimes there was foam acoustic tiling. And they had these huge loop arrays of speakers and microphones so they could beam stuff at the HomePod, pull stuff out of the HomePod, and just little HomePods in the middle of this whole room. And what was really cool is they had the iPhone team, and they have a whole iPhone vibration team whose only job it is to make sure the iPhone doesn't buzz or make low frequency sounds or do other things to disturb you, and to make sure that no matter where you put the headset on your ear, it sort of tries to beamform the sound from the speaker into the position that you're holding it. And they brought it in so that if you were asleep and there was no sound, you wouldn't hear any buzzes or vibrations or anything from HomePod, or you wouldn't hear any sort of noise distortions. And they went from room to room. They had a bunch of Apple employees who were testing it, and they got acoustic models back from them. Then they built a room that was the average of all the different environments that it was in, and they could tweak that to sort of figure out what it was like with ambient noise. And they had a room that was made out of concrete and steel, feet and feet of concrete and steel, that isolated all noise down to -2 decibels. And when they closed that door, it was just the most unnatural sort of feeling in the world. And they're using that to test sort of like noise coming out of the device. It was all super interesting.
Boy, after seeing all that, you'd be hard pressed to not think this thing sounded better than anything else. But does it really? I mean, yeah, seriously, can you put that out of your mind that they did all that and listen to it? Here's one of my concerns. It's very easy, and everybody does this. You know, there's what we haven't seen yet is the graph of frequency response, which we used to see, stereo review every time there's a new system they would have from 20 hertz to 20K, you know, the frequency response. And you want a flat frequency response if you want an accurate speaker. But as JBL learned early on and many others, Bose, nobody wants a flat speaker. You want a speaker that's tweaked to sound better, which often means little bumps in the equalizer at certain places. The problem with doing that is that it sounds better on some kinds of music and not on other kinds of music. And that's one problem with a lot of modern day speakers is that they sound great with modern pop music, but you, Andy, put them on your, you know, Donna Demaro
thing on opera
and it's not going to sound as good. And that's tricky. Now I'd be interested. Apple might be smart enough. They're putting enough power in this thing. It's got the brains of an iPhone 6 to know what kind of music's playing and to change even the frequency curve. So does it sound fine across the board? What is, did you do a curve? Do you know what its curve is?
No, So I'm the opposite of an audiophile, and I was approaching this like, would an idiot like me actually even notice a difference compared to different speakers? But they did explain as part of the tour that they made sure they did everything in those rooms to make it absolutely scientifically perfect, to be that sort of that neutral speaker.
But you don't really want that, I think.
No, so then they handed it off to the team of fussy audiophiles at Apple and the people who are artistic about sound, and they tuned it for human beings.
Is there a way in the settings to say what the frequency response is?
Not that I've seen. And it is continuously modeling. So it senses for any change in the room. It will sense changes in volume and remodulate everything so that the bass doesn't get deformed if it's too low or the volume is too high. So it's continuously analyzing everything about itself and all the reverberation and echoes and everything to make sure it sounds good. So I don't know specifically that it's adjusting for kind of music, but it is always adjusting for whatever metrics it can pull out of the environment.
Here's just for eye candy while we talk about it. iJustine unboxing her HomePod. And probably she's not conscious of this, but I noted she's not only wearing a Series 3 Apple Watch, but also a slave shackle bracelet. So she's got kind of the both worlds in there somehow. It's bigger than I thought, or maybe she's smaller than I thought. I don't know. It could be either one. Nicely boxed as usual. Beautiful cable normaled into the speaker, which is usually not a good idea because if it frays or breaks, you have to bring it to Apple to fix. Or Burke. Burke could fix it if you have a Burke. Round Apple sticker in there. So did you play it on a variety of music, Renee?
Yeah, I asked it to play a bunch. It starts off when you set it up. It asks you to ask for music right away because you don't have to do any sort of true play tuning, or you put the little speaker in the room and try to find this
sweet
spot. By the
way, let's look at that because she's showing the manual, which is a simple trifold like most modern manuals. But the setup is really cool.
Yeah.
Tell us about that.
So it asks you to ask for a song, and then it tries to pick a song based on its understanding of music that you've liked in the past. And as soon as it starts playing that song, it starts detecting the acoustics in the room, and
wow,
then it does all its self-tuning. And that takes between like 1, 2, 3, maybe 5 seconds. And it has an accelerometer in it. So anytime you move it, it'll automatically rerun that.
No,
so there's no
that's
separate.
Cool.
Yeah. There's no separate audio run or there's no like to go through.
Right.
It just does it on its own.
I also note that it pairs instantly, just like the AirPods do. When you open up when you put the phone near it,
yeah,
it just pops up. So you I think you'd have to have an iPhone or iPad, right, to use this?
Yeah, you absolutely do. I have the whole setup. I put it up on youtube.com/imorevideo, but you have an iPhone or iPad. The little AirPods-like interface comes up, and you just tap your way through it. And there's a few choices to make. And it's smart, too. Like, if you have accessibility turned on in your phone, it'll automatically enable accessibility or touch accommodations or any of the other accessibility features on the HomePod as it's setting it up. If you have Siri set to male American or female British, it'll copy that over for you while it's setting it up.
Let me go to your iMore review, because I want to show your setting up of the HomePod instead of hers.
Well, mine is just the setup, so you don't have to sit through the unboxing. I did a separate one just for the setup.
Yeah, nice.
But it works. Sorry.
Oh, I was going to ask: when you select your first thing for it to play, is the genre going to influence how it sets up the device? Like, this is going to be tuned towards, you know, folk acoustic as opposed to ear splitting metal.
No, I don't. I mean, I asked it to play a podcast first because, of course, I did.
That's probably the wrong thing, right?
No, totally. But then as you play more human music, like proper stuff.
So it continues to adjust.
Yeah, if it needs to, and as it moves around or as the room changes, like if it's in the corner of a of a bookcase. It knows that compared to if it's on against a wall, compared to if it's in the middle of the room. It senses all those differences in this environment. And if it's in the middle of a room, for example, it'll use those seven tweeters to send sound 360 degrees around. It's hard to think of it in terms of like stereo or 5.1. It definitely takes the mix into account. It always wants to represent what the artist wanted to do with the song, but then it takes that information and uses that to play sound in the room as best it can. And if it's against a wall, it'll bounce stuff off the wall to get the same sort of effect, to do the center versus the ambient placement.
So Renee, in his usual overachiever mode, wrote 10,000 words and a podcast and multiple videos. So you really have, is this the setup video in here? This is the unboxing.
If you go halfway through, it'll start okay. The setup.
Yeah. Yeah. See, that's the look that I like with the slate wall behind you. I like that.
That's what I'm going to have. For the pod. I actually have an adapter to make that camera work with.
Perfect. It's beautiful. So there's that little trifold again.
Yeah.
But you know, it's nice. That's all you need. So would you really use this instead of your stereo? I mean, is it that much better?
One thing I was going to point out too is it makes this little tone when you first start setting it up that is the same thing as the pattern on an Apple Watch or iPhone when you set it up, or the code you type in for an Apple TV. Oh, so it just knows that it's pairing to that device and you don't have to do anything else about it.
It's asking where are you putting it in the house.
If you have HomeKit set up, it'll ask you what room you're putting it in. Got it. That way, if you say turn off the lights, it knows you mean the lights in that room. You can say turn off all the lights if you really want all the lights, but it's aware of which HomeKit room it's in, for example.
Because, of course, Apple wants you to have one for every room.
Well, it's also useful for security. So, for example, you can say, I want to let anybody AirPlay to it. Oh. I want to only let people who are on my network, which means you've shared your Wi-Fi password with them and you trust them. Or I only want to share it with people who I've shared my HomeKit home with, which is generally only your family. And that prevents like Jim Dalrymple driving up and streaming Ozzy Osbourne to you in the middle of the night.
Which he would. If he could, you know he would.
He totally would. Yeah. He wouldn't come back to Canada to do it. But yeah, no, he totally would.
Hi, Renee. That's cute.
and it says, you know, it's like you can't tell, but I'm smiling. Like it does all these little sort of, it's very human. I mean, like that's the one thing that I think Siri and Amazon get really right in that they make it almost like a character that you want to talk with. And I get that Google is like, it's a Star Trek computer. I find that a character is just more relatable. And someone was asking me, like, they find it very uncomfortable to talk to it. But I think if you think about it, like Gem and Synergy or, Michael Knight and Kit, once it has a personality, it becomes more approachable to you.
It looks like you found a new friend, Renee.
I have a Sonos. I don't have it set up now, but I have a Sonos home theater system. And I've been using it for years. I have like seven Sonos speakers by now.
That's a fair comparison, yeah.
And it sounds unmistakably, even to my non-audiophile ears, unmistakably better than Sonos. There was an audiophile on Reddit who said it was about 20% better. I don't know what that means, but I can hear that it's cleaner. It's crisper. It sounds fresher and brighter to me.
Does the bass? Yeah, I could hear the brightness on it, but how about the bass?
The bass is good. The only thing that I find weird about the bass is I'm used to having a Sonos sub, and you know that's big and boom, and it rocks the floor. Yeah. And Apple went out of their way to make this not like it sits on the shelf, and it's not supposed to knock itself off the shelf. Yeah,
it can't.
So I do miss that. But if I didn't have Sonos, I would get this immediately. And even though I have Sonos, when AirPlay 2 comes out, I would strongly consider, I'm a nerd, I'm going to do this anyway, but I would strongly consider a paired match of HomePods instead of a Sonos Theater. I just wish Apple had a dedicated soundbar mode that if I want to say, right now AirPlay is great, it's sticky. So you pair it to your Apple TV, it'll keep doing AirPlay. If you ask questions, it'll pause what you're watching, answer the question, it'll say play, pause, all those things. But if you do anything else with it, if you do a different AirPlay stream or you ask for Apple Music, you then have to go on and repair it. And it's just swipe, swipe, click. It's not hard, but it's annoying enough that I wish I could just say, dedicate this HomePod to the TV. I know what I'm doing. Right. Pretend it's a soundbar.
Right. I hope you're all going to have a wonderful holiday season. I hope you enjoyed your turkey time. Hanukkah's already come and gone practically. But we're doing this. When are we doing this? Is this Christmas Day? Yeah. This is actually Christmas Day?
This is the day after Christmas.
Or as I think of it, noggin time. Oh, wow. That is good. Somebody pointed out, say thank you, that my eggnog had expired. But tastes brand new to me.
Mm.
One of the problems they had in the brand new campus, the Apple campus that opened up this year, Apple Park, they called it, is there's a lot of glass. Actually, Steve Jobs had a big hand in the design of the new Apple Park, the round spaceship campus. And he loved the idea of curved glass. He'd tell a story about the Fifth Avenue Apple Store, which is, if you've seen it, you know, it's kind of part underground, part above ground. They've redesigned it now, but in the original Fifth Avenue Apple Store had this above ground. It was all glass, the elevator down or the staircase down. And Steve, when they were designing that, said, make the panes bigger. They're too small. And make them bigger. And the architect finally said, Steve, this is also a wall. It has to hold up the roof. If you make them too big, it'll all fall down. I think Steve got his wish, though, with Apple Park. But there was one little problem. Well, watch. 911 recordings reveal there is a problem.
You can giggle at this.
You can giggle at this.
You thought iPhone 10 screenshots were a problem. You had no idea.
There is a problem. Houston, we have a problem at the new Apple campus. Apparently, the San Francisco Chronicle's done an investigation and has dug up some 911 calls like this one. I walked into a glass door on the first floor of Apple Park when I was trying to go outside. That's a January 4th 911 call. Two other calls made 2 days earlier, January 2nd, which was the day Apple employees started moving in. We had an individual ran into a glass wall pane and they hit their head. An Apple caller said on one of the calls they have a small cut in their head and they are bleeding, slightly disoriented. The other caller, we had an employee who was on campus. He walked into a glass window hitting his head, has a little bit of a cut on the eyebrow. None life-threatening nor requiring hospital visits, but the Chronicle is reporting that a city official in Cupertino, where the headquarters is located, had warned Apple about the risk of absent-minded employees walking into glass walls and doors. They have to be marked.
Looking at their phone.
Well, they have. You know what? If you have these doors, and we've had them at, you know, for years, glass sliding glass doors in California. Every house has them. You put stickers on them, right?
Yeah, they were putting stickers up the last time I was there, which was months ago. It's probably just a huge building, and they didn't have all the stickers in the right place. It's the same. I don't know if it's a stickler or a stencil. It's the same thing you see in the glass Apple stores, where they have sort of that frosted look at around eye level when you walk towards the walls. Yeah.
It's required by California's Code of Regulations. You have to identify and address hazards in the workplace.
I've walked into these walls. It's not funny.
It isn't. It's damaging.
No, I haven't done that at Apple, but I've done that myself at a place at twilight where they didn't. Yeah, there's a door to the left. There's entrance to the left, entrance to the right. There is just a wall, floor to ceiling pane of glass in the middle with nothing on it. Yeah, one of these bumps here is because of that. Yeah.
Nobody went to the hospital. Nobody was seriously injured. Apparently, some birds have been seriously injured, but no humans.
Yeah, we've had folks get bloody noses at clients. You know, you go not at Apple's, but at there's a lot of clients that we have that have a lot of glass in a lot of their offices. And we've definitely we had one client that had almost all glass everywhere, and you know one of our guys took a hit the glass really hard, you know, and so it's a pretty common problem with glass heavy solutions. This is not anything new to Apple. I mean, it happens probably every time they build a new one, and they go, oh, I didn't think that maybe we should put some markers. Eventually, it always ends up with designs.
Can I share with them like a little trick that I came up with at my old place? I did have like, again, big sliding glass doors. And every time that I would get like a new iPhone, and remember when they used to have like those adhesive covers on them for display purposes that had, I always used to put, when I was, as soon as I signed for the package, I was wrestling to get to my office with it. I would peel it off, unpeel it and put it on the glass. And yeah, I think that's what they should do. They should revive shipping iPhones with stickers.
I have a suggestion. Now, what's your name? What, say again? Seth. Seth works in Redding, Pennsylvania, Redding, California, in the school district there. He's installed many Apple computers going back to Apple II days, right? Many, many, many. He brought me exactly what Apple needs, which is some rainbow Apple stickers.
Yes.
Right. Just put those on the windows, Apple. It would fit in. It would be beautiful. It would have some great memories. Seth, thank you. This is, look, and guys, if you want me to send you some, I will. These are amazing. Well, all three of you have gathered together to celebrate the. You know, if Apple buys Texture, how long can it be before they buy me? I'm just saying, I'm for sale. Apple.
It's coming
for sale. We don't know how much. Prepared. Texture, our sponsor, which is a Netflix for magazine, $10 a month gives you 200 magazines. Now an Apple property. You said you talked to them about their plans, Rene Ritchie.
I started seeing different reports. Like some reports said that Apple was going to be folding. That Eddie Q had said that Apple was going to be folding it into the news app. And when CNN did not make the video or the audio of, I mean, for a TV show, they did not make anything available immediately. So I managed to get, you know, thanks to the generosity of some people, I managed to get a bootleg copy and very carefully go through it. And the
is this
question
of his
was very
South
leading.
By Southwest talk.
Yeah, South by Southwest talk with Daryl. And he said, you know, like the question was very leading, like what is Texture going to do for Apple News? And at the end, Eddie talked about the integration of them. And then a lot of people reported that as Apple folding it into Apple News. And when I asked about it, they said like no decisions have been made yet. And that could just be them covering their bases because maybe that's what they're thinking of doing, but they don't know if it'll work out the way they want or if the subscription service is more valuable some other place or if it's going to go in iBooks because that's going to be iBooks is going to become Books, a whole different app. So there's a lot of possibilities. I think they just want to keep their options open. But they did say a couple of things. One is that they're going to keep all the existing apps going because they have a big subscriber base. They have iOS, Android, Kindle Fire, and Windows. I think Windows 10, but it might just be a generic Windows app. And all of those are going to keep going. And everyone who's going to have the same functionality they've had before. It's only available in the U.S. and Canada, so it's not an international app by any means yet. And it's partly owned by Rogers in Canada. Strange partnerships there.
It was founded by publishers. It was founded by Condé Nast and Hearst. I think Meredith has a stake.
To be a Hulu Rogers. For magazines, yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah. I mean, it's easy to see how a lot of the conversation got misconstrued. He was, I thought it was a lot of interesting stuff he was talking about how the point he was making was that it was part of a larger sort of philosophical initiative to talk about the Apple News app as curated news, as a place where at some point some human with an IQ larger than room temperature has looked at this news article and said, "Okay, this is not garbage. We will let the Apple News app see this." And so he was talking about Texture as magazine content because it's been bought and paid for because it's not generally news of the last 45 seconds. It's a little bit better vetted, so he felt as though it's a better addition for that larger portfolio of like Apple News and Apple content. As this is a safe place, you can trust what we're talking about right here.
I'm sure it'll go. It'll be Apple treat it the same way they did PRSS, the digital magazine platform they acquired 3 years ago that was never heard from again.
I mean, they had a long record of. I mean, like there's the newsstand bodies still littering the streets. The Rupert Murdoch property. I'm blanking on the name. The Daily.
But those were shut down by the Daily. The PRSS is probably the closest thing to the Texture acquisition. Apple bought them in September 3 years ago, almost 4 years ago. And if I go now to the can you show my screen? If I go now to the PRSS website, it's a vital and growing concern. No, this website cannot be reached. They just basically took it over and shut it down. So I think all bets are off as to what Apple might do with this. It's clear that Apple doesn't want an app called Texture in its portfolio, does it?
Yeah, I could see that.
Really?
Sorry, go ahead, Alex.
I think one of the things that Apple may try to do, and maybe I'm wishful thinking, so we don't know, but I think that it does give you access to the idea of approaching publishers to possibly add more content that is more interactive into the content that's being distributed. So you know, I think that Texture is great. I'm a subscriber. I'm a user, but you still feel like you know this is still kind of taking an old technology and putting it into your iPad, as opposed to really building content that's designed for that next, whatever that next thing is.
Well, how all in is Apple on Apple News? Is that still important to Apple?
It's both important and not.
I'll make it very quick. I think that Apple News is not so much the app itself so much as the conduit. So long as it's part of that dashboard, the first thing you want to look at when you wake up and the thing you want to keep dipping into as the day goes by, I think that's a very important strategic solution for them.
So this would make sense as something that would, as Eddie Q did or did not say. What was the actual quote, Renee?
I actually spent part of the night transcribing it, so I would have it available.
All right.
So the question was, how does acquiring texture advance the grand strategy of Apple News? And at the very end, Q says that, well, basically I'll tell you what the whole thing he says is, I think there are a few things that we've always cared about at Apple News. First of all, we wanted to bring great articles from trusted sources in a beautiful layout. And that was the premise of Apple News we started with. If you do that, lots of customers will use it and love it. Obviously, texture with the brands I just told you about, they have magazines from Esquire to Vanity Fair to Times to Sports Illustrated, some of the best magazines in the world. They have some incredible content, and content takes a long time to create. So they are in-depth articles. And so we're really excited about bringing that into Apple News to augment all of the other stuff that we have from thousands of other publishers. But the key to our key is curation. We want the best articles. We want them to look amazing. We want them to be from trusted sources so that we don't have a lot of the issues that have been going around in the marketplace.
So I can see why that was synopsized as they're going to fold it into Apple News. That's sort of what it sounds like.
The other point
it is Schrodinger's app in several ways. It is Schrodinger's app in several ways because it came out. It launched in the U.S. It quickly went to the U.K. and Australia, and then it stopped. Apple put out Apple Music in 100 countries at the same time, the same day. They haven't done that for news, but they have spent a lot of time improving the features of news. It's got Siri-based machine learning intelligence. They've been doing a wonderful job. Now they're doing March Madness, but they did the Winter Olympics and they did the Oscars. And they've got a huge team of editors. They've hired an editor in chief, and I think what Apple sees is almost like they think they have part of Tim Cook's mandate, and it was Steve Jobs' thing too. They want to save news, which sounds ludicrous on its face, but they look at Amazon and Google and they have these problems where they basically took other people's content and monetized it and sucked all the revenue out of it, and it's destroyed a lot of publishers. They said, come on, we'll put you in Newsfeed, we'll put you in Facebook Video, and then they turned around and said, oh, sorry, we don't mean it, and those companies went bankrupt. And I think that Apple has almost like an Aaron Sorkin-esque romantic feeling of what news can be and what news should be and how it can power and inform and create communication. And they want to, as much as they can, use iOS as a platform for doing that, similar to how when they acquired Beats, they used that as a platform, sort of created an all-encompassing music library in the sky.
Yeah. Advertising came up a lot during that conversation, in which this, when you're getting content from these magazines, you're not necessarily getting content that needs to be subsidized by advertising. This is a point that Eddie Q was making, that whereas stuff that comes online, at some point you have to get people to click, you have to get people to actually imprint an ad on the thing. And this will help to elevate the level of content to have this texture content. It's more complicated than that, however. A lot of you forget about how much newspaper ad revenue came not from people not from people advertising, you know, the things that you see advertised on the web typically, but you're talking about classified ads, you're talking about legal ads, you're talking about just like the weekly supermarket supplement, you're talking about things that would have gone away anyway. Unless someone firebombed an LCD plant and made sure that phones and tablets never existed. So it's a little bit more complicated than that, but this is the first time I've heard Apple talk about news as something other than, oh, well, these other people have this app, we're going to have this app too. It's interesting for them to brand it as part of their overall company identity as, look, it's a nightmare out there because of largely because it's ad-based and profile-based content. We're a safe place where you can be. We're not going to tell you that it's the safest. It's objectively no danger of anything happening everywhere, but at least you can trust if you click on an Apple News app that there are fewer shenanigans going on than maybe you would find elsewhere on Facebook and Google.
Is the business model for texture, is it the same as Netflix, where, or not necessarily Netflix, but let's say a lynda.com or something like that, where everyone getting an equal amount of income, or are they getting it like per sub like we would with cable?
They haven't said anything.
Because that'd be really
private company, so they haven't disclosed almost anything.
Right, because it's interesting. Yeah. It'd be interesting to know whether it's based on like how many people are reading your magazine, as opposed to like maybe you get a base amount per sub and then a higher amount based on usage. And I'd just be curious, how that looks. But I do think that, you know, what Apple gets access to, depending on how they use it, is a lot of walled gardens. A lot of the content in those magazines is not ending up in Facebook, is not ending up in a lot of these things, because they don't make it available unless you're a subscriber. And so I think that those are things that are now going to be accessible in the news feed that haven't been you know, and it may increase that. If you feel like you can, publishing through texture is going to give you a larger market and you can end a sustainable market, you may be more interested in doing that than putting it up on the web.
Yeah.
Well, particularly basic income for publishers.
But particularly if this deal gives them the launching pad from which to develop deeper relationships with magazines like The New Yorker, with Esquire, because they have deep, deep, deep content. And so we're not just talking about nostalgia buffs who would like to read Frank Sinatra Has a Cold by Harlan Ellison, which I recommend you seek and find out because it is a hell of an article. But it means that when there's a piece of news, like when Harlan Ellison finally dies, there's going to be lots of obituaries, but here is the place you can find one of his most important pieces of writing, and it will surface right to the top. When there's,
if you look for that one, though, you won't find it. It's Gay Talese. But other than that, yeah.
I'm sorry, my part.
Well, I would like to read Harlan Ellison's version of that, however.
I forgot because one of the key scenes in that is Harlan Ellison picking a fight with Frank
Sinatra. It's a wonderful article, which everybody should read. More of our holiday special coming up in just a bit, but you know, this time of year, it's a stressful time for all of us. New Year is coming, right? And it would be also a good time to make a resolution maybe about handling stress in your life, finding a new way to be calm. It's our new sponsor, Calm. Calm, CALM.com. The number one app to help you meditate, to help you sleep, to help you relax. Apple's app of the year last year, a part of Apple's best of 2018 list this year. If you head to CALM, Calm.com, I have to say it carefully, CALM.com/MacBreak, we've got 25%. Now, this is calming. 25% off a Calm premium subscription, hundreds of hours of programming. I really love listening to Calm. Yeah, you know, if you go to the webpage, you'll get an idea of what I'm talking about. It's just beautiful. Guided meditations. They cover a lot of the kinds of issues our modern lives are filled with. Anxiety, stress, focus is nice. There's a brand new meditation every day that you might want to just do, the daily calm. I like that. You notice I'm talking more calmly. There's also sleep stories. This is really kind of cute and fun. Bedtime stories for adults, I guess, designed to help you relax before you doze off. And you know, they have some of the best people. My favorite is Lavender Fields. Stephen Fry, he takes you to the Lavender Fields of France. Kimmy would like that. She would immediately know we're in Lavender Fields. Carson's wife is a lavender expert, apparently. I didn't know that. Explore New Zealand with Game of Thrones' Jerome Flynn. Wouldn't that be fun? I love those British accents. They help you drift right off. For a limited time, MacBreak Weekly with listeners can get 25% off a Calm premium subscription at Calm, CALM.com/MacBreak. We play it in the bedroom at night as we're going to sleep. It's very calming. Calm, CALM.com/MacBreak. You'll get unlimited access to all of Calm's content today. And I know you're probably watching this, you know, it's either Christmas Day or a couple of days later. Maybe it's Boxing Day. Did you forget somebody on your list? Calm.com/MacBreak. And, you know, it starts at home, right? Giving starts at home. Give yourself the gift of calm to start 2019 off right. CALM, Calm.com/MacBreak. I feel better already, don't you? We thank Calm for their support of MacBreak Weekly. Now back to our best of. I'm looking at the picture of the line waiting to get in at Chicago's Lane Tech College, which is, despite its name, a high school. A lot of people in the rain waiting to get in. It's a big school. Early on, Tim Cook said, It produces more PhDs than any other high school in America. Of course, they don't get their PhDs there, but they go on to get PhDs. And it seems like it was a very good place to have this event. It is a public school in Chicago. Apple had, you know, there was a lot of speculation about what Apple would announce, but I can, in a nutshell, tell you what they announced, which was kind of what the minimum speculation was. A new sixth generation iPad featuring the A10 Fusion processor and pencil support. No smart connector for the keyboard, just pencil support. And it will be $329, the base price of the least expensive iPad up to now, $299 for educators. That's a 32 gig storage device, so it's kind of a minimally configured device. They still nothing new about the pencil except a $10 price drop for education. It'll be $89. And there were a lot more software announcements than there were hardware announcements, although they did point out that Logitech is going to offer a $49 pencil for the new iPad. I presume with iPad Pro pencil capabilities, they're calling it it looks like a crayon. It's a digital crayon. And there, Logitech is offering a $90 a keyboard design for this particular iPad, neither of which the crayon nor the keyboard will be available to the general public, but only to educators and students through Apple Education. So don't get your hopes up. It will be available later this summer. You can get, though, the new $329 sixth generation iPad is available for order today, and you'll be able to pick it up or get it delivered by the end of the week.
And this was not a big price drop, but just more features in the same price.
Yeah.
I mean, or, yeah.
Which is, I'm frankly a little disappointed. And I think, you know, what Apple was trying to do was get into the education market to fend off a real significant challenge, as we've talked about before, from the Google Chromebook. And I thought one way to do that would be to offer a lower price. They decided not to do that. They do say it's faster than a Chromebook. Somehow I don't know if schools really care about that. They talked a lot about software, and there is a lot of new software designed specifically for the classroom. I'll show you one of the videos they call homework.
Settle, please. Event. Eyes up here. We're not done. Group three. Let's have Ivy and
Ivy
Michael.
Is not excited, nor is Michael.
Ryan, Sally, and Thomas.
None of them too excited or thrilled because they're about to get homework.
Your homework is to explore gravity.
I should point out he did not drop an iPad. And in fact, one of the weird things about this is all the kids have iPads, but none of them are in cases, which, of course, would never happen.
Of course, but Apple never shows them in cases.
Yeah.
They need cases.
Yeah,
Friday.
The keyboard cover on that one.
Homework.
Homework. Now, I think, I'm not sure, maybe, Tanya, you know, it sounds like a Shel Silverstein poem.
It is. It is actually.
Okay.
Homework, or something like that. Yeah, it's Shel Silverstein.
Okay, listen.
Oh, homework. I hate you.
They're buying
you
a watermelon.
Stink. I wish I could wash you away in this thing.
You guys ready?
If only a hippo would smash you to bits.
They dropped an egg and then a watermelon off. And it tastes good. That's going to be part of their gravity.
I'd rather take baths with a man-eating shark.
Notice the use of the pencil.
Wrestle a lion alone in the dark. Eat spinach and liver. Pet 10 porcupines.
They're dropping a mattress off the balcony. The parents are going to love that.
Action.
Making videos. Gravity-free environments. This is a lot of work these kids are putting in. I think Apple's saying
homework.
The kids are doing this because they have iPads, right? Because otherwise they'd just be, you know, sitting at home
you
watching
TV.
You
are last on my list. I simply can't see why you even exist.
It's the most creative kids I've ever heard of.
If you just disappeared, it would tickle me pink.
Next up, group three.
Homework. Oh, homework. I hate you.
And now they're showing their video. But we won't get to see it because we are adults. And adults.
But I'm sure it was amazing.
I'm sure it was wonderful. So they have some new software that will let teachers monitor classroom performance, shared assignments with kids. I think the biggest announcement from my point of view, from most people watching's point of view, is they're finally going to update iWork. And it looks like, and I bet you have some interest in this, Alex, they're going to take iBooks Author, which you were really excited about when it came out, but really did not take the world by storm. And they're going to fold all of its capabilities into Pages. So
we'll see if they fold all of them or most of them. I have a feeling that, I mean, for me, this is kind of falling backwards a little bit as far as going from iBook Author to Pages. I mean, Pages is fine, and I'm sure that it'll be more. You'll get more books out of it than having a separate application. Now people can just use that. I think that not a lot of people use iBooks Author, and not a lot of people use Pages, and so maybe you can get them to combine into a reasonable number of people. So I think that Pages has always been for me a little heavy. It just feels heavy when you use it. It's not as responsive. It has lots of great media tools that just feel slow when you're working with them. So, it's not something that I've used, that I even use heavily. So I think it'll be, to create something that is a slightly better book, I think that Pages is going to be great. I still think they're missing the opportunity to build something great.
The new Pages will have pencil support. Users will be able to add drawings and use something called Smart Annotation. The underlines and annotations aren't just illustrations sitting on the page. They're somehow attached to the words around them. So I guess when you reflow the document, the annotations, you can see here in this animation that go around with it. Pages will also allow book authors to include photos, videos, graphics from Apple Pencil, and more. Share finished books into iBooks. That was kind of one of the key features of iBooks Author. Group authoring will be enabled. Teachers can, in fact, group support for all the iWorks apps will be enabled. Teachers can annotate, send in documents to mark work. There'll be a new presenter mode in Pages, transforming the iPad into a teleprompter. You can set a screen of text to auto scroll at an adjustable speed. And then there's a new app for teachers called Schoolwork, which lets teachers dole out digital assignments to students. Apple also talked a little bit about the augmented reality capabilities of the new iPads. Actually, it's the same as the old iPads, except there's a faster processor. But they did point out that there are going to be a lot more AR apps for students in education. Schoolwork will also support ClassKit. We'd heard about ClassKit before. It's in iOS 11.3. That means third-party apps can link into and out of Schoolwork. So I imagine that'll happen as well. I am not an educator. I've had some, I've worked as a trustee for a high school for 6 years, and I have had kids, as you have, Tanya, in school, as you have, Alex, as well. I'm not blown away by this. I actually had hoped Apple would do maybe a little bit more for education. It's great that Apple celebrated education, but I thought they would do a little more. You agree, Tanya, or disagree?
Well, it seems incremental. There's nothing here that's really, surprising, but it seems as though Apple is kind of waving their hand and saying, hey, we are thinking about education and we are taking some baby steps. And a couple of the steps they took, I think the Schoolwork application, we have to see how it will really work in the real world, but it seems like a positive step. And one thing that I noticed was that they will now be supporting on iPads bought for education, the ability to have more than one account on an iPad.
That's
huge. That sounded awfully interesting, particularly for a school that's trying to get iPads into the classroom, but they can't afford one iPad per kid. That could be pretty huge, depending on how it works out. We don't want the kids to have to spend 20 minutes a day just logging in and out of their iPads, of course, but hopefully it will be much more smooth and elegant. So it feels like Apple's putting a number of things out there kind of almost to see what might become most popular, most used. They've got the AR, they've got the idea that kids could be doing a lot of digital media creation, they've got the pencil now, affordable, it's a much more affordable iPad that you can now use the pencil with. So it gives teachers a lot of different directions and schools a lot of different directions they could start moving ahead in if they so wish. Apple also, I think by making this announcement and choosing to go in this direction, they're saying once again that they're really not planning to come up with anything like a Chromebook competitor. Right. They're doing something really different.
Yeah, this isn't so different at all. In fact, Apple showed things like this, you know, dissect a frog application, Frogopedia, so you can dissect a frog with a pencil, but not a real frog. But this has been around for a while. What's new is that you can use a pencil to do the dissection. It's an augmented reality app. It might be better using a pencil than your finger. But yeah, I'm actually a little disappointed. I was hoping to see more, frankly, from Apple. Not necessarily more hardware, but just more aggressive support for education. Maybe even some subsidies and bigger discounts. It doesn't feel like this is something that is going to change the equation when it comes to schools and the iPad. Alex?
Yeah, I don't think they're trying to take over. I think that they are taking the schools that are on the edge and trying to lean them a little bit their direction. So they're handling a bunch of the management issues that were definitely way behind, and then trying to show where they stand out against the Chromebook. There's just a lot of those very interactive, very fun things that they're showing there are definitely more difficult to do on a Chromebook than they are on an iPad. Obviously not trying to be a Chromebook, because that's going to be harder to go down that path. But I do think that they are trying to show where they tried to look for areas in the education market where they exemplify.
The big story of the week this week comes from Matthew Panzerino in TechCrunch. I don't know. He didn't mention anybody else being there. He was one of the five journalists invited to Apple last year during the famous apology tour, where Apple said, oops, we blew it. The Mac Pro is a dead end. We have painted ourselves into a corner, and we won't have one for you this year. But we're working on a new one. Matthew went back almost exactly a year later to Apple and got a little peek under the kimono. And there is a Mac Pro, but it won't be ready this year.
Yeah. Wouldn't it be great if they at least showed off something? I think one of the nicest things one of the most valuable things that came out of that piece was Apple's acknowledgement that their normal position of utter secrecy and denial until they actually unveil the thing was not working out for people who, you know, have to make plans for buying new hardware at a certain set rate of time. So they made the point of one of the reasons why they're conducting these interviews and making these semi-announcements was to reassure people that here's what we can show you to reassure you that if you are going to be in a position we're going to need new hardware in 2019, we might have something for you. But if you need something this year, you best make other plans, because that really kneecaps a lot of people.
I think that's so true. I think I know a lot of people who, you know, they're always asking me about whether or not they should upgrade their Mac. And when it comes to professional Macs, this is definitely something they need to know. Should I invest now? Should I put this on this fiscal year? Should I wait? Is there going to be something in September? If I buy now, did I just waste my money? And I think it was really smart on Apple's part to be transparent about the fact that it's not coming this year, and it'll be here next year, but they didn't even give us a specific timeline. Next year could be in the first quarter. It could be at the end of the year. But I think it was really smart to kind of let us know, let the professionals know that if they're thinking of buying, that they're not going to get a new Mac Pro until 2019. And if this has to do with, you know, kind of keeping your financial records together, you might go ahead and purchase at least some of those professional grade Macs before the end of the quarter, because you're not going to get anything new until 2019.
All right, I'm going to give you the negative spin.
That's not a surprise.
Apple saying, please buy an iMac Pro. They're saying, I mean, you're right. It's that message, but it feels like you're saying, oh, isn't this wonderful? But really, what it's Apple saying is, look, just buy the iMac Pro. Please don't wait for a Mac Pro. I understand that's of benefit to some people, and I even said they should tell people if they're going to make something this year or not. But it could also really be that they're saying, you know, buy the iMac Pro, please buy the iMac Pro.
I don't know that that's what they're saying, though. I mean, do we want the choice here seems pretty clear. Apple can try and release something because people expect it, or they can wait, make sure it's ready. And, you know, a whole new modular design, whatever that turns out to be and whatever the form factor turns out to be, will be released when it's actually ready to go. Imagine if they release something that really wasn't up to what they wanted. People would be all over it. We'd be slamming them, saying, why didn't they wait? So instead of doing that, they come out and say, we're not going to have it this year. You know, make your plans. If you want to buy an iMac Pro, that's, you know, people can do that. It is a powerful machine. But if you want to wait for this new modular design, then here's our sort of timeline.
Yeah.
Next year.
We did see that with the previous Mac Pro, to be fair. Here is something that you have not been asking us for. That does not meet your needs as you choose to define them. Good luck.
Bob, but innovate my ass. Tom Boger, Senior Director of Mac Hardware Product Marketing, Panzerino quotes him as saying, we know there are a lot of customers today that are making purchase decisions on the iMac Pro and whether or not they should wait for the Mac Pro. He doesn't finish that sentence, but I think I can finish it. Don't wait. Right?
Well, that's correct to a certain extent. Again, it's valuable to let people know that if you were holding off for, let's say, WWDC particularly, to say that I bet that they're going to announce something then.
Yeah.
To have at least a year in advance, knowing that no, nothing is coming in 2018. You don't need to. This isn't waiting for Godot. You may as well leave the barren spot with a tree, go back to your motorhome with a microwave oven and the TV, because you're gonna have to dig in. I think Apple is also savvy enough to know that a lot of people. This frees up them to not simply say, well, I'm just going to have to buy an iMac. It does free up a lot of people to think, okay, this is where I switch to Windows because I can't wait another year and a half.
That's not what Boger meant. That is not the rest of Boger's sentence.
No, I know that's not what he meant, but that is part of the effect.
There are a lot of pros that will wait.
Yeah.
And some of those industries, including music, are already a bit further behind than what they already have, because in music, I don't know about video or photography, but in music, once you get your system set up, you leave it alone.
Right.
I mean, sometimes there's no updates, there's no nothing, because it's working, it's recording, and any downtime is money. And if they do get a new machine, a lot of times they'll run that in parallel to the old machine that they know works. So you know that a new machine is going to come with the newest operating system. And a lot of times that won't work with some music software until it's updated.
That's a good point.
So
yeah.
Even my music machine, the one that I record all my things on in Logic and Pro Tools, is always an operating system behind. So I'm not running High Sierra on that machine intentionally,
yeah,
because it works right now. And I know when I go in and I plug in my guitar and I set up the mics, I get everything rolling, everything is going to work. If I update something, it could break. So my point is, for those industries, it's not necessarily a bad thing that they're waiting a year. You know, they're not going to care that much. Next year. Yeah, studios may bring one in.
But you're not, I'm going to bet, Jim, you're not using the trash can Mac Pro either.
I am not. I'm using an iMac.
Yeah. So you, because that's the real problem. People who bought, as I did, a Mac Pro in 2013 are now sitting in year five saying, oh, another year? Right?
But I don't think that
they're
going to
buy an iMac Pro. They're going to.
Well, they may. Yeah. They may.
I mean,
that's a definite option with the iMac Pro being as good quality as it is. I think that was one of the reasons why Apple kind of went for that, is that they're not, the Mac Pro is just not going to be ready in time. So here's the supplement. If you really feel like you have to upgrade, if you can't wait, here's the iMac Pro, and it works great. And it's going to satisfy a lot of people's needs. But at the same time, just like Jim is saying, it's true. The people I know with Mac Pro that are using them for music recording or graphics design, they are running old software programs. They're running old operating systems because they don't want to break what currently exists. And so they're the waiters. They're not in a hurry to upgrade. They'll wait until 2019. Whereas there are some people who maybe their machine, maybe they're just excited and they want to try something new and different. The iMac Pro is definitely an option, but at the same time, for those Mac Pro users that need that Mac Pro spec, I think Jim has nailed it that they're willing to wait for sure.
I also think Apple has benefited from Intel's laggard improvement of their chips, that even a late 2013 Mac Pro probably doesn't feel too slow compared to 5 years later, mostly because Intel hasn't really done that much to make their chips that much faster. I doubt there are many pros who are saying, oh man, I can't use this Xeon E5. It's just too slow compared to what I need. Nobody's saying that, in fact, I bet. What you do want, though, and what was missing in the trash can Mac Pro and is missing in the iMac Pro is modularity. And that is the good news from Matthew Panzerino. Apple says it's going to be a modular Mac.
Andy was just saying, it depends on what you mean by modular and how modular. But if you look back to the Mac Pro, the silver one.
The cheese grater, we fun.
Cheese grater. I mean, I had a lot of PCI cards and things like that in there from companies like Universal Audio.
Right. Can't do that very easily. Although they have eGPU support now. In High Sierra. And I don't know if eGPU means you'll also have the ability to run those external cards on a PCI slot, external PCI.
Well, part of the problem now is that when Apple moved away from those things, all of these companies came out with external DSP to take the load off of the CPU so that when you're running plugins, it doesn't tax the computer as much. It taxes what used to be the PCI card. But now is a piece of outboard gear that's sitting on your desktop or around the console.
Boger also says there is absolutely a need in certain places for modularity. I'm sorry, I can't get off of my spin. But it's also really clear the iMac form factor of the MacBook Pros can be exceptionally good tools. I mean, okay, I guess I'm seeing it through a certain filter. I do think modularity is pretty important, but you make an excellent point. If modularity hasn't been available for 5 years, maybe everybody's moved on to the next thing. Andy,
it depends on how you want to define. As always, what does the word pro mean? For some, it might mean a specific workflow, a specific type of usage. For me, it's always meant we, the manufacturer, are not going to dictate to you how you must use this machine. We know that you will have very peculiar and specific needs, and we'll give you a platform that will let you make modifications or build a system that will really be focused to what you want to do. And historically, that fulfills a really wide range of users, not just the people who are doing pro audio, doing pro video, but also people who are have outgrown the needs of the level of a base level, let's say iMac, a consumer oriented iMac or consumer oriented Mac Mini. They just need a little bit more oomph. They need more ports. They need a little bit more resources for these one-off projects that they are pounding their head against once or twice a year, as opposed to 12 months out of the year. That's what you're sort of buying. That's kind of what I think has marked the difference between, for instance, the MacBook Pro and the ordinary MacBook line. And that's always what I've sort of felt the desktop line to be as well. So my bigger worry would be that they really want to get such a specific data oriented idea of the typical Mac Pro user that they once again sort of lock you into a track where, no, you don't want to have expansion cards. You want to put everything on an external bus instead for sound and for video. And we're going to let you do all that by buying all this other stuff, which, again, will work great for a lot of people who are making a lot of money with their Mac Pros. It won't do quite so well for people that, once again, they've outgrown the consumer grade, but they're not making a fortune off of contracts that they're fulfilling with their desktop system. So we're going to have to wait and see what they really have in mind for us.
Yeah.
But I think those people that are in between, that's where the iMac Pro comes in. You know, because they do have a lot of the outboard gear where you plug into Thunderbolt or USB or whatever, and they can, if they need that extra power, they can still get it. I think the Mac Pro, especially in the modular design, is going to be for those high-end, very high-end professionals. And I think the power will show that, and most likely the price will show that as well. But it's going to be a high end machine. So, yeah.
But once again, in this case, I'm only speaking personally, but I just don't have a use for an all in one machine. It just isn't how I tend to work. I like to have, I have a really nice monitor that I'm already screened that I'm very, very happy with. And I like being able to have it on an arm so I can position it anywhere. So I would be, if faced with the problem of, I'm going to either have to spend money for a screen that I don't want and a form factor that isn't what I decree to be optimal for my use. Once again, it's a case of, here's $3,000. You're going to have to adjust what you want to what we're willing to sell you. Which admittedly is always going to be a problem when you have a company that isn't going to license their designs to anyone else or let anybody else make Hackintoshes or stuff like that. But nonetheless, it's always going to be a problem that consumers are going to have to deal with as they continue to evolve as users.
Yeah, but I really don't think that you or even me, even recording what I do, are the market for a Mac Pro.
Yeah,
you know, the other machines are so powerful. You know, not even Leo sitting at his desk right now is probably not the market for the Mac Pro. However, the back end of what Leo does with all the streaming and everything else, that could be a market that they're looking at.
Oh, sure. So, although it's too late for many of, I mean, it's too late for us. We bought Windows machines running Premiere. Because,
well, it's never too late, Leo. Look, just set fire.
We're not switching back. Unless Microsoft dumps the pro market, I don't think that's going to happen. I know I've been drinking eggnog during our holiday special. Put aside the eggnog, my friends. It's time for Hopsy. When you come home from work, hard day, you'd like to put your feet up. You'd like to relax. You don't want to go out and go buy some craft beer. Wouldn't it be nice if you had a little keg in your own house? I do. It's my Hopsy. This is like the Keurig for beer lovers. Let me show you this. This is the amazing Hopsy sub home draft system. It's really simple. Hopsy comes in these bottles. They're about the size of a bottle of soda, right? But this is not soda, my friends. Oh, no, this is a Czech premium pilsner. Oh, I love the Czech style pilsners. This is from Gordon Biersch. What's great is you open up the top and you'll see inside there's just a little plastic nozzle that fits really easily right into the top of the Hopsy. And then you snap it closed. It's refrigerated, so it's staying cold. And let me just I'm just gonna get a little bit out of this. Now I'm probably not doing it right. You know how to pull a good, right? You've used a tap before. You get this glass wet and stuff. You gotta tilt it just right, and I'm gonna get myself a little glass of, I don't know what we're drinking today. I think it's an IPA. I'm not going to do the whole thing, but that is a beautiful, beautiful glass of beer. They have all different kinds of beers from big and small breweries, consistently rotating. It's a club. You get Hopsy beer every month without the price tag of these fancy beers. You get your own draft beer at home. This is, they call it the sub home draft system. It fits right on your countertop. It keeps the beer cold. It's on tap. I'll tell you what, people come over and you say, you want some beer? And you do this. They go, wow, you're living large. You don't even have to have a home bar just to do this. Hopsy ships these mini kegs directly to your home, even to your office. Yes, this is in the office. It's fun working for Twit. And let me tell you. Oh, yeah, that's an IPA. That's fantastic. Juicy, fruity, delicious. They've got different packages for the holidays only. So I want you to do this now. I know it's you know, Christmas and everything, but get yourself a present. You deserve one. You can get the Sub Home Draft System. How much do you think you'd pay for that? Right? It's got to be expensive, right? It's made by Krups. It's beautiful. It's a great device. You're going to get the Home Draft System. You're going to get two mini kegs of a delicious beer and two nice hopsy glasses, $99. That's $140 savings because they want you to get started. And plus, you get free membership in their Hopsy Monthly Beer Club. You start by selecting your holiday package. Best sellers, your favorite beers from the best breweries. IPAs and pale ales. See, Paul doesn't want that. They're hot right now, but Paul's not an IPA guy, right? Hazy West Coast Session pale ales. I think Paul would go for the easy drinkers. It's kind of like summertime on tap. Actually, these are what I like. From lagers to Kolsch's to Pilsners. Yeah, all the exotic beers you hear people talk about from the best breweries coming to you on tap in your home. This is kind of a dream come true. Afterwards, you'll choose four mini kegs every month as part of your subscription plan. That's about equivalent to a six-pack, one mini keg. So that's exactly right. Up to 2 weeks. Each mini keg, I should say, stays fresh for 30 days outside the Sub Home Draft System. So you got a month, and then you put it in, you got 2 weeks inside the sub. And 2 weeks is plenty of time. Frankly, they don't last 5 days here. We go through them pretty fast. We love our hopsies. It's the perfect time to treat yourself. Or, you know what? Wouldn't this be, if you're a boss, a good holiday gift for the office? For the office crew, treat yourself or a friend to Hopsy. And just for the holidays, a great deal. Here's what you do. Go to tryhopsy.com/MacBreak. tryhopsy.com/MacBreak. Again, when you use the promo code MacBreak, what do you get? You get this incredible sub home draft system. Two mini kegs of beer. They just fit right in here. It's going to go a little when I open it. I'll do it just so you can see. There it is. Here's the keg, the mini keg right in there. Just pops right in. Actually, you know what? I think we're due for a new one, he said, wanting to try this Czech Pilsner. So I'm going to pop it out. Pop the Hopsy. Take it out. There you go. Yeah, we are due for a new one. We'll pop in. No, well, I get it. We got a choice. We could also do a wheat. You want to do the New World wheat? This is from Hermitage Brewing Company. I don't know. I'm going to do the Czech Pilsner. Is that okay, everybody? You don't mind? Watch, just pop, this is how easy it is. You pop it in, just like that. The nozzle goes right in here. That's where the tap is going to be, right? It snaps in. It's that easy. Close that. Close this. It's going to make a little noise as it chills it and pressurizes it, because that's how it turns it in. Well, that was fast. Pressurized, ready to go. As soon as I finish this, I'm moving on to the Czech Pilsner Hopsy. Go to tryhopsy, tryhopsy.com/MacBreak. Well, I guess I got to have it from you. And use the promo code MacBreak. Special $99 holiday package deal. Terms and conditions apply. This two, love it, monthly supply. Oh, look at that. Oh, that's going to be great. This is called Live in Large, my friends. Cheers. tryhopsy.com/MacBreak. Use a promo code MacBreak. Let me try it. Ah, I feel like I'm in Prague. That is so good. It smells good too. I'm sorry. Let's get back with the show. Let's see. This is the bad news I was talking about. There is a box from a company called Gray Shift called Gray Key that is designed to unlock iPhones, and apparently law enforcement just loves the Gray Key. Motherboard God. Has the story. It is a relatively cheap tool. It is something that they have to have the iPhone and plug it into. According to Motherboard, it works with iOS 11 on an iPhone 10, and that's a little bit of a shocker. We've known there have been backdoors in older versions of iOS, but this is the current iPhone. Secret Service is planning to buy at least half a dozen gray key phones, phone boxes to unlock iPhones. State Department has bought it. Drug Enforcement Administration interested. The FBI interested. Many local police forces, like the Maryland State Police, the Indiana State Police, the Indianapolis Metropolitan Police Department. Actually, the Indianapolis Metro has received quotes from Gray Shift, but not yet bought the Gray Key, according to Motherboard. It's a 4x4 inches box.
One patch and that thing is a paperweight.
Yeah. Right. It's not cheap. $15,000 if you want one that has... that is gives you 300 unlocks and it has an online connection. Or if you're willing to pay twice as much, $30,000, you can get the unlimited version. imagine that.
Everyone's using the freeware model. It's like, if you want the good stuff,
freeware.
You got
freeware. Yeah. Now,
did you see Matthew Green's tweet, Leo?
No, what did he say?
This is his estimate of how fast it is. 4-digit passcode. 13 minutes, worst, average 6 minutes. 6-digit passcode, 22 hours, worst, average 11 hours. 8-digit passcode, 92 days, worst, 46 days, average. 10-digit, 1,000 days, worst, about 5,000 days on average. Sorry, 10,000 days, worst, about 5,000 days on average.
That's why I have a 17-character passphrase on my iPhone now. So it's we believe it's a brute force device, that it doesn't have any secret back door. It just brute forces.
They're somehow stopping the SEP from counting the amount of times that it's done enforcing the delays and then doing the deletion after 10 attempts.
Right. Right.
Yeah. See, this is why I'm with Renee. Like, it's the success of this box is predicated on Apple's inability to raise $15,000 to buy one of their own. Because as soon as they see how it works, boom, it just stops working. And even so, there is no magic CCAM astronomy backdoor password to unlock a phone. It really is has to be one of these brute force things. And that's easily negated by someone being very willing to inconvenience themselves once every 2 days by typing in a 12-digit password.
Yeah. Yeah. So if you're really worried about this, have a longer password. I have a 17 alphanumeric. That's a pain in the butt. But fortunately, I don't have to use it very often, thanks to Face ID. What did he say? That would be a long time to brute force.
What's the entropy level of the universe again?
A long time. Seems like we just the other day we were doing our Christmas show for all of you. It was a whole year ago. I hope you've had a lovely 2018. I know it's had its ups and downs, but I hope your family and friends are doing well and okay, and you're, you know, wrapped in the bosom of your family at this holiday season. You know, the years go by so fast, it's kind of hard to believe, but I remember it very well. 1998, 20 years ago, we launched Tech TV in May 1998. Shortly thereafter, Steve Jobs had come back, and Apple launched Steve's first computer. Remember the Bondi Blue iMac, 20 years old this year. In a way, we also celebrated this week the 20th anniversary of the original iMac. And it's fun, which was, I think, on Sunday. It's fun to think about where Apple was 20 years ago compared to right now. 21 years ago, when Steve Jobs came back to Apple, it was just a few million dollars away from bankruptcy. So everything that's happened in the last 21 years has been remarkable.
And then shortly after, it was as if Steve had just started where he left off. You know, it was kind of he left with the Mac and came back, and I just went, and then we're going to do the Mac again. You know,
he drew that famous quadrant where he said, you know, because they had dozens of products at the time, and he said, you know, and by the way, they were also selling clones when Steve came back, right? He killed that immediately, drew the quadrant, said we're going to have professional, consumer, portable, and desktop, 4 products, that's it. And the iMac announcement was the consumer desktop, right? So here, I'll put a little bit of Steve here talking about his iMac.
Come on in.
He's bringing in a camera, so
you
got to
see this thing
off
in person, but I'll do the best I can with video. This is iMac. The whole thing is translucent. You can see into it. It's so cool. We've got stereo speakers.
Some of that
laughter
is probably coming from Apple employees who watched Steve have a fit the day before, according to Walter Isaacson's biography, because he couldn't get it lit right. And he said, we're going to stay here until it looks right.
Yeah.
He also had a fit over the button on the front of the iMac, because he had been told, he said, John Rubinstein had told him, you're going to have a slot, and instead it had a drawer. And in fact, he, according to Isaacson, almost canceled the introduction of the iMac the day before over that small point, and only went ahead when Ruby was able to convince him, well, next one we'll have a slot. Okay, Steve, okay? Watch how much he loves the handle, too.
We've got infrared right up here. We've got the CD-ROM drive right in the middle. We've got dual stereo headphone jacks. We got the coolest mouse on the planet right
Okay, wait a minute.
Oh, man, it was so...
The worst mouse ever.
It was the coolest mouse in that it did generate the frostiest reception.
you could say it was cool. You just can't say it was functional, right?
It was a third-party opportunity for other mouse makers. Yes.
There you go.
Come on around. All of the connectors are inside one beautiful little door here, the Ethernet, the USB stuff. Around the back, we've got a really great handle here.
Now, I should point out, this is a 38-pound computer. No one is going to use that handle. But,
well, no, it was an echo back to the original Mac, so that's part of the design story they're telling. But also, there are times where you actually would like to move a computer from one room to the other, not because it's portable, but because, again, you're in an office and you're sharing, or you're in a school.
You don't need a handle, Andy, to do that.
Well, yeah, if it's 30 pounds, you need a handle.
Johnny Ive put the handle in. He was actually a little nervous because this is a very expensive case. I think it was $60 per. And I put the handle in, and he said he was very nervous about what Steve would say. But he said, look, we got to put this here because it communicates that it's friendly and it's easy to shift around. Whether it's functional isn't really the point. And Jobs got it and loved it. What he doesn't mention here is a significant missing piece.
The back of this thing looks better than the front of the other guys, by the way. And then around the side.
Steve.
So let's take one more swing around it so you can see. This is what it looks like. And again, you've got to see one of these things in person.
It was very pretty.
$1,299. G3 at 233 megahertz. Had 32 megs of RAM, upgradable to 128 megs. Not gigs. 32 megs of RAM. What was missing was a floppy drive. As it turned out, that might have been the biggest story of all. That and the Bondi Blue, because people didn't make computers in colors back in those days. But the fact that Apple would make a PC without a floppy drive... Now, that was the courage I think Phil Schiller was referring to.
I was trying to think of when I stopped using floppy drives, but it was
people were still using them at this time.
Yeah.
But they put those USB ports on there.
And the USB.
Yeah, really, and the CD, and said they were right in that case. Mm-hmm. Ironically, this Mac has three headphone jacks.
Right. I think the last time I seriously used a floppy drive was probably 1995.
Yeah, this is 1998.
Right, so 3 years, had already been, it was already kind of dead for...
Yeah. No, it really wasn't.
Well, for me.
You were using files that were huge.
Yeah, we were using zip drives and SideQuest drives. Remember SideQuest?
Oh, I remember those. Oh, yeah.
Bernoulli boxes?
Oh, yeah.
I was unpacking some of the last boxes, and I found my MO cartridges.
Magnetic optical media,
yeah, which were pretty damn cool and they're shiny and stuff. But I every time this does come up a lot, this is something that I like to counter, at least to present the other side of the argument, that people say, yeah, see, and Apple was ahead of the game and they've made the computer of the future and brought it to us early. So, well, again, we forget about what an absolute colossal pain in the butt
at the time
it was to own an iMac at that time, because again. Yeah, eventually people got rid of floppies, but it was still, there were no flash drives. It was not, there was no Dropbox. It was still very, very important to a lot of people. So that's why a lot of people were buying third-party floppy drives that were designed to look in Bondi Blue by other makers. There were not, USB was a brand new, practically a brand new standard. So it was really, really hard to find anything that would plug into it without something that would adapt to your old printers and stuff. Just on and on. So make sure that that's part of the history as well. That that's why I really don't like the courage story, because, again, it's easy to be courageous when your users have no option but to drop the entire platform and switch to another operating system. It would be courageous if the Mac and the iPhone were just one maker of computers that use that stuff. I could buy a phone with a headphone jack that runs iOS that is not an iPhone. So that's why I just don't like. I'm not angry about it, but I don't like the word courageous in correction to this. Also, and also, let's remember with the iMac, they really had to make a first impression. They had nothing to lose. So as a quote from Steve Jobs that I hope is permanent. That look, there's nothing that feels worse than failing with something that you didn't believe in to begin with. And this is the iMac, I think, was the inculcation of the idea that if he's going to fail, if this is going to be the last Mac Apple makes, they're going to fail with a Mac that Steve Jobs and everybody who works with it really believes in and really thinks is a great machine.
I had FireWire.
I miss FireWire. the connector story has been really a choppy and ugly story. FireWire was born too soon and died too early, or born
well,
too late.
You know, I think that it was so the rumor.
It replaced SCSI. Let's not forget
the rumor
and parallel ports.
Right. The rumor of its success for Apple and its demise was that Apple really pushed really hard to get all the camera manufacturers to add the FireWire to their cameras, because now you can just hook it into your PC or Mac or whatever and do it. Apple then pushed because they were part of the consortium
with Intel,
so they pushed a royalty payment out,
right?
You know, for the PC manufacturers, right. And Apple paid it too; they didn't care. But the PC manufacturers wouldn't pay the royalty, and Steve Jobs knew they wouldn't pay the royalty, and he knew that they wouldn't put it in their computers. And what it meant was for years the only easy way to get video into your computer was on a Mac. Well, the only way to get video in was a Mac and a camera. So it was like it just owned that market. He didn't care about the money. He just wanted to make sure that they put their feet in the mud. Now, in the end, that's what killed FireWire, because then this big market builds up, and right. And then Apple decides it's going to change it, because they're really the only ones. And right. as the camera manufacturers,
is the same thing happening with Thunderbolt. No.
No, I don't.
I see Thunderbolt on a lot.
Intel's really dropped the ball on it. I mean, they dropped the ball on that and the DisplayPort connector. I think they were supposed to be three generations ahead what they are now. They announced DisplayPort ones at 1.3 and 1.4, and I don't think any of them have shipped yet. And I don't think Thunderbolt is on schedule either, and that's entirely
Thunderbolt's also confusing. I think that's its biggest problem.
Well, they said it was a benefit that it would match USB-C, but now people buy one and not know what it is yet. They just think it looks the same.
What are the capabilities? It's the same connector. What does it do?
Right.
Yeah, and what are the cables rated for?
Right.
I mean, it's and you have a poor Google engineer has to personally review every one of them.
And it's not only that, but you get situations where to save money, you might have like two or three USB-C ports on a device, but one of them is basically just like a USB 3.0 port. One is a video port. One is super, super high speed that can be used for networking, as opposed to there are a lot of things I don't like about the ports on the MacBook Pro. But one of the things I absolutely respect is the idea that, nope, these are four absolutely equal, top of the line, you can do anything with them ports.
Yeah, I do. I have to admit that I stayed with the 2015, as I see you have, MacBook Still. Pro, because I wish it had Type-C Thunderbolt, but the fact that it has USB and HDMI and SD card reader.
SD cards, yeah.
I know. That actually is a compelling thing to have those ports.
For me, it's literally just the MagSafe. I would give up everything else. I wish it had Type-C
charging. I would prefer Type-C charging because it's universal now.
No, my problem is that I just travel so much.
You knock it loose.
Having been able to, here's where it really becomes an issue, where I look down and I go, I don't want, is when I'm on a plane plugging into the little, the connector there.
This pinpoints why it's so hard for Apple. And you kind of brought this up, Andy, too. As the only source of Macs, they have a problem because they can't make you and me happy.
Right.
Right. You want the MagSafe, I want Type-C.
Renee's
happy with four Thunderbolt ports.
I think that if Apple had just...
Andy.
If Apple had just left the right side of the computer the same and put two C's on the other side... That's
what Lenovo does. They have their traditional charger on one side and a Type-C charger on the other side.
Leave all the connectors on one side the same. Put Type-C on the other side as the transition laptop. Right. If they had done that and then done whatever they're going to do.
That doesn't have any courage. There's no courage involved in that.
I wish they'd be a little more fearful.
To me, it always comes down to the keyboard. We'll talk actually a little bit about what Apple's plans are with MacBooks in just a little bit. I just thought we'd celebrate a little bit the 20th anniversary, 20 years ago, May 6th. By the way, they announced it May 6th, 1998. They didn't ship it till August, I think, of that year. It took a while for it to come out. We immediately, that's roughly when it was the same time frame as the launch of ZDTV. And we immediately ran out and bought as many Bondi Blue IMAX as we could. So we get our hands on. Really nice computer. I have never asked you this question. Do you like the new Macintosh laptop keyboards? Are you a butterfly girl?
Yes, I am. This is such an uncomfortable situation for me to be in. I have the 2016 MacBook 13-inch MacBook Pro with the Touch Bar, and I have had zero complications with the keyboard. But I know beyond a shadow of doubt there is something wrong with that keyboard when thousands of people have had issues with it. So here I am recommending to my friends the new MacBook Pro, and I'm watching person after person after person tell me that they've had some kind of breakdown with their keyboard, that they had to take it in, have something replaced, take it in a second time, had something else replaced. It's dangerous territory here. And I really think Apple needs to address this. I think the petition to recall the Apple keyboard, it's on the right path. I don't think the computer needs to be recalled, but I think that similar to the way Apple released a repair program for the Series 1 Apple Watch for the battery overheating and breaking apart the battery, the watch case, it's something like this. It needs to be addressed. Apple needs to offer something to help people repair their keyboards. And it has to extend well beyond any existing warranty. So my MacBook Pro is fine right now in 2017, not even a year after I bought it. But what's going to happen in 4 years, 5 years? Is my Mac keyboard going to have the same kind of issues? And I'm out of warranty and I have to pay $700 to get it fixed.
That's part of the problem is how expensive, right?
Yeah.
Yeah.
You have the Butterfly One, Lori, the first generation, which I tried and rejected and got rid of that exact laptop that you have. I also didn't like the Touch Bar, but that's another story for another day. Then I got the next MacBook, which was Butterfly Two. That was a little better. I acknowledge that, but still bugged me. Now, Apple Insider actually went out and did some deep data diving. They collected data from Genius Bars in the U.S., which is interesting, as well as Apple-authorized third-party repair shops, to collect the number of problems with number of keyboard incidents. So the MacBook Pro, which had the old-fashioned keyboard and the from 2014, and I'll put 2015 in there, we're talking 2,120 incidents in 2014. Of them, 118 were keyboard problems. That's pretty good. In 2015, there were 1,904 episodes and 114 keyboard incidents. But then a big jump when you get to 2016, you had fewer total incidents, 1,402, but a big jump in the number, almost a 50% jump in the number of keyboard incidents. That seems to have settled down in 2017, but then these are newer computers. Yeah, maybe the Butterfly 2 fixed it. Yeah. Yeah.
Yeah, but with the class action suits, I thought it was interesting that there are two plaintiffs named, one of which bought their MacBook, I think, in 2015, but the other plaintiff bought theirs like this year. They bought it in January and they had problems in April. Which seems like good tactics. I made a note yesterday when I was reading the complaint that now I need to learn how class action suits work, because one of the things that the suit is claiming is that not just that these are problematic keyboards, but they are fundamentally defective. Not only are they defective, but Apple knew that they were defective, and that's part of the reasons why the suit is going forward. And I'm not sure how they're going to prove that. because this isn't Apple had a problem with
they need a smoking gun email to Tim Cook from 2016 saying these keyboards, we're having real problems with these. Before release, something like that.
Yeah, it was
chances
like
the slim, I would guess.
If the old timers like me remember the Twiggy floppy drives, the original Lisa.
Yeah, that was
where
a problem.
Apple, they were so determined not to go with another. They were so determined to go with an in-house solution that, and they could not get the damn thing to work, and they had to ship on time, and so there are all kinds of legal issues afterwards because they could prove that they knew the thing just didn't work properly, right. But they had made the ship date. So I don't know. I agree with Laurie. I think that I don't think that we necessarily need a recall, because again that assumes that the entire design is defective. I don't think that's the case at all. But a warranty extension, I think, is exactly what is called for here. Just they don't have to have a big mea culpa. They don't have to say anything. They don't have to advertise anything. But if you come in with a keyboard with a problem, yes, the first time you bring it in, they're going to spritz it with the compressed air, like the service note says. But if it's clear that if you come back again, they're just going to swap out a brand new keyboard and not charge you for it. This is why it's always worth it to bring a problematic Apple product back to the Apple store, even if it's out of warranty. I had my MacBook Pro 2015. Obviously, it's like out of warranty by 2 years, and I got after lots of use, I got what I thought was a normal replace. Your battery is finally bad. Replace it. And I thought that, okay, old age, I've been using it over and over, and I was going to have to pay to replace the battery. It's not going to cost that much money. But they took it in the back, and they realized that like a couple of the cells were swollen, and they replaced the battery for free. So again, it's not something that was advertised, but it's always worth it just to see if they'll do something for you under their "we're awesome" policy. And this is, if there's ever a time for Apple to be awesome, it's to make people convince people that if they have a keyboard with a problem, it's not going to cost them $700 to fix it, because for $700 you can probably get a Windows laptop with a much better keyboard.
I should point out that Rene Ritchie was the guy who put these numbers together. I think Apple Insider published percentages mostly. And the total number of incidents is not the total number across the board, just the ones that Apple Insider counted. What's relevant is the percentage of the total incidents that were keyboard incidents. And that did go up a lot in 2016. But nevertheless, even if it's 12 or 13% of overall, that does not rise to the level of, oh, my God, this thing is broken. So it is really more of a goodwill. I think it's going to be more of a goodwill they have to convince Apple of than of any failing. I mean, that's a small number.
Well, goodwill doesn't pay for lawyers. So the lawyers are going to want the whole thing.
Well,
but you're right.
See, what I'd like to see is the outcome is Apple rethinking the butterfly switch making a better keyboard next time around.
I would like them to just get rid of the keyboard. Like I love the
what
iPad.
The hell are you
like
talking
literally
about?
Get rid of a keyboard.
Just like everything to be iOS.
No, iOS. If you look at like a Surface, the Surface is great because you choose what you want. You know, like that way Andy and I can have big keys, and then other people can have butterfly keys, and you just attach it to the thing and put it together. It could still be Mac OS. By the way, when I say I'm realistic that I don't think Mac OS is going to last forever, I don't want to give it up because I still spend 90% of my time that I spend on a Mac or on an Apple device is in front of a Mac.
The petition at change.org hasn't quite raised 25,000 signatures. I don't know how many millions of these they've sold, but that's not a huge number. Mm-hmm.
Also, I mean, who care? People like signing electronically a petition that means
mean
nothing.
Anything. Yeah.
That doesn't mean anything. Yeah. But I do think. We've heard from too many people who've had these problems to think that okay, well, you know, there was a fly got into the transporter chamber. It was a one in a million problem. I think that there is a weakness. I think it's been demonstrated there's a weakness to this keyboard that makes them. So, once they go bad, they're just bad, and you're just not going to. There's no way to really pop off that keycap, get in there with a Q-tip and an isopropyl, and get that key switch working properly.
I mean, I think the physics of it are obvious. When you have less travel, it's going to be much more sensitive to anything that goes wrong. You know, I think that the physics of it just makes sense that the thinner these keys get and the less travel they're going to have when you hit them, the less reliable they're going to be. You know, so I think that. And I think it's easier to have grit and all kinds of other stuff. I mean, I know some people that just go through keyboards because they use them outside, you know, like they use them in construction sites. And so they, you know, so it's, you know, they go through certain ones faster because of that.
I don't know which device I can shake more crumbs out of, the tray at the bottom of my toaster oven or my laptop keyboard. So it's a tough problem to solve. I don't think that Apple engineers have been lazy. I just think it's a big problem.
How does that holiday poem go? 'Twas the night before Christmas, and all through the house not a creature was stirring, not even a mouse. The children were nestled on their Casper mattresses, sleeping soundly with visions of sugar plums. There's Casper in there somewhere. There ought to be. If there isn't, we'll have more of our holiday show in a bit after I tell you about my mattress, the Casper. Love me some Casper, an online retailer of premium mattresses for a fraction of the cost. Look, this is a perfect time to tell you about Casper, because you, if you have kids, you haven't got a lot of sleep. You know, you're kind of woke up at, did the kids wake you up at 5 in the morning? Come on, we got to open the presents. You ready for a good night's sleep? You need a Casper, the original Casper mattress. Now, just imagine, if you will, you're going to bed on this tonight. Has the original multiple supportive memory foams. It is magical. It's a sleep surface that with just the right sink, so your bony bits go right into there. But it's firm and it supports you, just the right bounce. How do they do it? Sink and bounce together in one mattress. And maybe you've tried other mattresses. I know I have. And have you noticed you wake up, you're sweating, you're drenched? Because they don't breathe. The Casper mattress breathes. And that's important, so you can sleep cool. It turns out, sleep research, you do need to be a few degrees cooler than during the day in bed. It's just the way it is. It's biology. So you want to sleep cool, regulate your temperature through the night. You will sleep better. Really, that's what Casper's all about, having a much better night's sleep. Long-lasting comfort and support. You can buy it online easily. It's completely risk-free. Casper has reinvented. Seriously, they were the guys that changed the mattress industry. Oh, yeah, everybody's copying them now. But Casper, these are the guys who said, wait a minute, there's something wrong. You make a mattress, but you don't sell it to the customer. You sell it to a store that doubles the price or more, marks it up, then sells it to the customer. That's wrong. We want to sell direct to the customers. That's exactly what they do. But you see the problem here. Customers think, oh, I got to go lie on it in the store before I buy it. No, no, no. Here's the deal. Casper, you don't have to lie on it in the store. You get 100 nights to lie on it in your home, in situ, as it were, in the situation, in as it is. So you really get a sense. I'm 10 minutes in the store, 8 hours on the bed, night after night. And if at any time in the first 100 days you go, nah. They will come. They will take it, refund you every penny. No trouble on your part. It's very easy. The reason they make it easy to return, mostly, I think, just to reassure people, because no one returns them. They're great. Once you sleep on a Casper, you'll say, what was I? I've heard Leo talk about this. What was I thinking? Casper knows how to make a great mattress. And, by the way, they're all made in the USA, upholding the highest environmental standards. That's actually important because they come in a box, right? In a very surprisingly compact box. When you open it up, whoosh, and if it weren't made with the highest environmental standards, it might smell like something. Nothing. I've had other big name, expensive mattresses. You had to air out for a few days before you really felt comfortable sleeping on it. You know what I mean? Not this. Put it on the bed. It's ready to go. You're going to love it. Free shipping. You love that. Plus, free returns, U.S. and Canada. Get a Casper mattress today. You can save $50 towards select mattresses when you use our website, Casper, CASPER.com/MacBreak. And then use the promo code, if you will, MacBreak, during checkout. That way they know you saw it here. And that makes us happy. It makes them happy. Makes everybody happy. And you're going to be happy. You're going to go, oh, Leo, why did I wait? Casper.com/MacBreak. Promo code MacBreak. $50 off selected mattresses. Terms and conditions apply. I wish, to be honest, I were lying on my Casper right now. But on with the show. The show must go on. I'm going to go take a nap while you watch more of the best of MacBreak Weekly. We have birthday cupcakes, not just for Alex Lindsay, But today is the 10th birthday of the Apple App Store, the iPhone App Store.
We were born together. It's us, the App Store, and Nikola Tesla.
Tesla's birthday, too.
I'm pretty sure.
Well, in that case, I'm going to have another cupcake.
Have a cupcake.
All good things.
I'll have an electric cupcake.
In honor of that birthday, we will sing the first four words of Happy Birthday, which you get for free. If you want to buy a pack of 20 more words, an app purchases of $5
or subscription. We already sang it. It's too late. you did the chorus, and I think you did more than 10 words, Andy, so expect a bill. 10th anniversary of the App Store. Anything you want to say about that? That was a big deal. Is it my memory incorrect? Didn't Steve Jobs not want an App Store at first?
So that's an urban myth, and I've talked to a lot of people about it who were actually involved at Apple at the time working on it. And Apple is a platform company, and Apple always wanted iPhone to be a platform. However, it was so hard to get the iPhone to ship by June 2007 that they had zero bandwidth to actually come up with an App Store strategy. And the teams were so exhausted that there was no way they were going to get it done anytime soon. It was going to take a year, maybe more than a year, which is why they tried to do the web app as the suite solution. But then that fell with such a thud, they had to go and say, look, we know you just did a forced march. You just did a marathon of sprints. Can you please pick yourselves up and do it again for next year? And they all just looked at each other and said, we absolutely have to do this. And they had a little debate about whether it should be AppKit or WebKit. And even the WebKit people said, no, it can't be WebKit. It's just not there yet for this kind of stuff. You can have web views inside your apps, but you need Coco. So they came up with UIKit, and then they busted tail to get that ready for that February event. And I think basically did another forced march for the remaining 9 months and got it done.
Well, it turned out to be a good thing for sure. It's created an entire economy around it, and it's generated a significant amount of revenue for Apple. I don't know how much of the $9.2 billion they made last quarter in services was the App Store, but I have to think it was the lion's share.
A lot. Yeah. And it made apps popular, and it made developers, like, it brought them all into popular culture. Now, it used to be an obscure thing that maybe you got like the Adobe licenses or Microsoft Office at your business, and maybe you got some shareware or freeware, but it wasn't the like movies or music or, you know, even video games. And now it is popular culture, and developers are popular culture. Like, people think about it as a astronaut, fireman, I want to make an app sort of a thing.
No, it's really true. I get calls all the time on the radio show. I got a brilliant idea for an app. Can you tell me somebody who can write it for me? It's like, dude.
I mean, it's incredible democratization about Flappy Bird.
Kids, 10-year-old.
Is it Flappy Bird?
Flappy Bird, yeah.
That was the poor guy.
Little Vietnamese kid. Teenager.
Was not ready for the... Yeah. For selling,
couldn't
whatever,
believe he made things. Millions.
Yeah, in a place that you're not supposed to do that.
I meet 10, 11, 12-year-olds all the time who want to write, and some are actually writing, and some have even published apps in the App Store. That's a great thing.
And the fact that it's so inexpensive and it's so easy, and you really can build a business around it. It's almost like the next generation of delivery.
I wonder, though, how many app developers make money.
A lot of businesses don't make money either. I mean, like, you know, most restaurants go under, most other, you know, there's.
Is it harder to make a success in the App Store than it is
as a restaurant? It's much less expensive than a restaurant. And you're only dealing with yourself.
I mean, your spare time.
The risk is a lot lower.
There's definitely plenty of people who fail at it. And then they say, oh, well, you can't make any money on the App Store. But then there's all these people that, you know, it doesn't mean that you can just put it up on the App Store and expect everyone to use it. You still have to think about VR.
It has to be great.
You still have to have.
Has to be great.
Yeah, it has to be. And that's the thing, is that the UI, the user experience on an iOS app has to be very good. I think that unless you do something really obscure, you cannot have anything that's hokey. Because I know as a user, I pick it up, oh, this is hokey. You know, like, and I just stop using it almost immediately just over the design. You know, unless something is, you know, that. So you still have to think about that process. And I think that a lot of people don't. They just throw it up there and go, well, no one bought it. Well, yeah, there had to have been some work around that, you know, to make it work. But I will say the other thing that I've talked to a couple of folks that, getting recommended on the by Apple,
that helps.
It's like literally some of them have retired on that, just on a recommendation. I mean, a well built app and then showing up on the front page is. There was someone I knew. I'll not make it specific, but that their app was featured in one of the ads, and they just said it was stunning.
It was enough to buy a house in a week.
There are, and again, there's not that many other places in the world other than sports, which is just as random, you know, that you could make that much money that quickly. You know,
there was a couple articles about the Trism guy and Twitter, Tweety guy, like Lauren Richter, and I forget the Trism guy, but how much they were making at the height of the App Store, and it was ludicrous numbers.
Yeah, yeah.
But that is such an apt analogy, though. It's like there are people who can start with nothing and by the age of 18 be signed to a 5-year NBA contract worth $10 million a year. And that's what gets all of these kids like neglecting their studies to make sure that they become really good at basketball, because they don't imagine themselves being one of the 92.8% of aspirants who blow out a knee at age 14.
Yeah, but the difference is, though, of course, the difference is that when you turn 18 and you don't get signed, all you know how to do is play basketball. You know, when you turn 18 and you don't get signed for this, you know how to program.
You can code.
You know, that's a really good skill. It's a skill that almost everybody wants. So it's not a bad thing. I'm trying to slowly pull my kids into programming just so that they...
Because you don't want to work
Swift? Would you teach them Swift?
That's all I'm teaching them.
You got to Swift.
Well, I mean that and a variety of coding for Arduino and you know, that kind of thing. So it's a little bit of mixture. The idea of thinking about it, At first, I don't want them thinking about they could get a job or anything else. I just want them to see that using electronics and coding
is just fun.
It's just to fix things. That's why we were talking about like how to water the plants or how to do these other things. It's just how to fix things. Like,
I think if you're going to succeed as a coder, you got to actually enjoy it.
I learned how to code because I was I was tired of rolling dice for Dungeons and Dragons.
My first
app was something just created non-player characters, because I was a dungeon master and I was like, this is taking forever to build all these non-player characters.
That's actually really good incentive. Yeah,
you know, and so that was my impetus, and then I did rocket trajectories, which is much more interesting. Learned a lot more.
Yeah, that's why I don't like when people show me curricula for programming. I'm always kind of bummed out when it really is more like, we're going to teach you how to do math. Like, no, that's not how programming works. Just, you know, we give kids paper and crayons and tell them to draw whatever they want. We don't teach them all about the history of the crayon. We don't tell them about how varying pressure can create varying lines. The way to teach programming is to say, what kind of app is not out there yet, but you'd love to have? And doesn't have to be. We're not talking about making success in the app store. It's like for you, little Alex. What is the little Alex app? So I want one so that every time I have a piece of gum, I can keep track of what kind of piece of gum I had and how it lasted. Great. So we're gonna, for the next 4 weeks, we're gonna build a little Alex's piece of gum. How long did that last app? And that's how you learn step by step.
Right.
That really is the way to go. But one thing I really wanted to respond to, though, is that. I don't think we should give all the credit to the App Store. I think there's a three-legged stool here that the App Store would not have had. You need the App Store, you need a powerful mobile device, and you need mobile broadband. It wasn't with any one of these three legs of the stool missing.
I agree.
Neither of them would have been quite so good. We had mobile apps and stores where you could get mobile apps, but we didn't have an internet and we didn't have something as well done as the App Store. And it wasn't just the App Store. It was that someone decides to write an Instagram app that can suddenly take this. You're no longer taking your phone home and syncing these wonderful 2-megapixel images and then emailing them to people on AOL. You are basically saying, hey, here I am. Here's my food. Here's the person who was mean to me at the parking lot. And that's what gets people to the App Store to find out what the next app they want to get is.
I hope you're enjoying our holiday wraps. That's that, Rudolph. It's okay. Calm down. Mac Break Weekly, a wonderful 2018 it has been. You know, I think back to the movie. Remember the movie The Social Network? Where Sean Parker meets Mark Zuckerberg in a loud, crowded bar. And Zuckerberg says Facebook could be worth a lot, $1 million even. And Parker tells him, you know what's cool? $1 million isn't cool. You know what's cool? $1 billion. You know what's super cool? I feel like Dr. Evil. $1 trillion. Apple was aiming for it. Finally did hit it. Watch. Oh, yeah. Did we mention Apple at $1 trillion market cap? Did we mention that?
I mean, it's a vanity metric, but what a big number.
Well, you
and
know that
it really is. For a little reality check there as well, is it's a vanity number, especially given the fact that it wouldn't be anywhere near that if they weren't spending hundreds of billions of dollars buying their own stock back. I mean, there's a little bit of a, you know, the stock, when we really talk about stock value, I mean, I think Apple's doing great. They're going to keep on making more money. That's great. But that is not what's giving them a $1 trillion valuation. What's giving them a $1 trillion valuation is basically taking a otherwise stagnant stock and basically inflating it by buying their own and keeping the investors happy. Otherwise, people would have moved on.
I'm also impressed that they've managed to become a $1 trillion company without amassing a whole bunch of really terrible scandals. Like, I have so much respect for so many things that Amazon has achieved, but I do not like the fact that every single conversation about Amazon that consists of more than four sentences has to include the phrase, but they treat their lowest paid workers like crap. That Facebook is a very successful company, but they are essentially a beehive full of horrible ideas implemented carelessly with thought to how best to protect its users from the community that its own servers have created. Whereas Apple, all you basically get are a couple of really intense attention-getting, oh, well, they're recycling a certain element from their phone frames, but they could be recycling more. Or, yes, they're paying their workers their subcontractors in China very, very well and treating them very, very well compared to other manufacturers, but maybe they could be treating them well. So the fact that you always take things tongue in cheek when you have a company that likes to position itself as, oh, well, we are a very ethical company and we are a very green company and we are very, very positive and we have values that we feel that are very, very positive. But Apple tends to actually deliver on that stuff too. So that has to be mentioned.
And I think that one of the things when we look at those stock buybacks, the only thing I was going to say is that I think that one of the things we see here is this schism between Apple's personality, I think, and how much money they're making. They're actually making money. They're focused like a startup, you know, and they're making money like the biggest company in the world. And the problem is they literally don't have a culture of, we could just experiment with a bunch of things. We could take that $100 billion and we could buy T-Mobile and create a cell network and buy something else and do this. You know, they don't want to be distracted and they have something that works. I think that someday down the road, we may say, well, that might have been a good idea, you know, to get distracted and move into other businesses. So far, they've been able to leverage this really well, but it does create a pretty, you know, like very top heavy situation where if the iPhone collapsed for some reason, Apple would still make billions, but not in the same way.
Actually, when you talk about stock buybacks, it reminds me that Elon Musk this morning dropped a bombshell on Twitter. Not the first time Elon's done this. This morning, a couple hours ago, I'm considering taking Tesla private at $420. That's per share. Funding secured. Yeah. And then he tweets, good morning.
But he's, yeah, unfortunately, he's almost becoming like what Donald Trump is to high-level politics. Elon Musk is becoming. Because he says these things and you don't know whether you can dismiss them because maybe he had a bad fig in his breakfast or something, or this is just a passing thought that he's not really going to commit to. Didn't the stock like just or maybe he was just
they've actually the market's taking seriously the stock suspended trading, so whatever he's meant, he's certainly had an effect. There's no doubt about that. I love the we were showing the Times infographic from last Thursday on what $1 trillion is. It's Apple is worth way more than all the major automakers in the world. Apple is worth more than the entire media industry, the American media industry. If you put Netflix, Comcast, Disney, all the major news publishers and all the TV channels, it would still be $848 billion, less than the trillion that Apple is worth. That's a lot of money.
It seems like every single time there's either an article. There's never been a really cool like animated infographic like that, but they all like remind me of the same SCTV sketch where it's like a Russian broadcaster with a big map of the USSR behind him saying, look how puny they're now. I'm going to take the country of Australia, massive continent. Yes, look how tiny it is when we put it inside the borders of Russia. Now let's add. It's like, okay, that's fine. I mean, but it's the fact that it's a $20 company. It doesn't help that keyboard any, does it? And it doesn't solve the dongle problem.
No, and in fact, we say that every time we talk about, as we have for the last 20 minutes, stock pricing and quarterly results. It's only a small indicator in what we care about, which is, do you want to, you know, how do you use your Mac? How do you use your iPad? What do you
want? Totally different game.
It's a different game.
Okay, let's go on to the new iPhone X. I wouldn't say that it was a remarkable update. Here's in broad strokes, here's what happened. They took the iPhone X of last year. And they did two things to it. They gave it the nominal incremental upgrade that we often see in an off year, with matching the same prices and keeping the same, like, sort of prestigious surgical stainless steel, as was said during the keynote, and the wonderful OLED display, screen to screen, and upgraded the processor and all this sort of stuff. That was nice. They also added a new, in addition to the 5.8-inch screen display that has on the regular iPhone XS, so we don't say XS, 5.8-inch.
They want you to say XS.
Yeah, I see. I see Apple's. Let's have a sidebar here. I think Apple has lost its product naming mojo. I mean, I think we're all old enough to remember the day when it was possible to buy a Macintosh Centris XL747. That's different from the 745 because the 747 was a label exactly for the Sears stores, and the 746 is the one that was available at Office Max. And so now we're dealing with, we got the XS, which is the super expensive. That's how I'm remembering it. It's the XS, super expensive. That's the $999 phone. They have added the 6.5-inch XS Max. That does not roll off the tongue, I will tell you that. And now the top price. In addition, one of the many features in a very long and technical rollout of this device during the keynote of the new A12 Bionic processor is that now this can address a whopping 512 gigabytes of storage. So if you want to get the largest amount of money, if you're really just there to make sure that by the end of the year you've spent as much of your expense account as you possibly can before it rolls over, you can buy a 512 gigabyte iPhone XS Max for $1,449. If you're going to cheap out the XR, the smaller version will max out at $1,299. So you got the XS, the XS Max. Underneath that is the quote unquote budget version of this, the XR, which they cut a few corners. Instead of getting stainless steel, you get aluminum. Instead of getting an OLED screen, you get a LED display. But this is Apple, so they have to tell you it is a liquid retina display. One of the most amazing LED displays ever shipped. They'll be shipping a month later. And that one is going to be less expensive to the tune of starting at, I believe, $799. Were both of you a little bit confused? And are there little birdies just sort of tweeting in circles, cartoon-like, around your head, trying to keep all of these things straight and their features?
Mostly, I'm confused why you keep calling it an iPhone X. It's a 10.
It's the letter X. Okay, it's the letter X. If they wanted to call it the iPhone 10, see that the, was the iPhone 9, okay. Was the iPhone 8 called the iPhone like VIII? It was not. It was called the iPhone 8.
No, it was not.
8.
So you don't call it the iPhone VIII. You call it an iPhone 8. This is the
if they wanted it to be the iPhone 10, they would have had a 1 and a 0. They put an X, so they wanted me to call it the iPhone X. And also X is cooler.
The best Star Wars movie is not Episode V. Andy,
Patrick Stewart does not play 5. Professor 10. He plays Professor what? X. I rest my case.
Okay, And what operating system does your computer run? Because it's not OS X, sweetie. I love you, Andy, but you're calling it an X, and it's killing me.
Well, I think that's the OS 10 is where this all came from, because yes, we all knew that it was telling us that we were moving to Unix, and so it was like OS. So to us, it was like OS X, because it's like Linux, it's like Unix, it's like, and so all of us just kept on saying OS X. You know, not all of us, but many of us did, and it just seems silly to call it OS 10. I think that we've just never really gotten out of that habit of like when we see that, I know that they say 10, but we're going to just keep saying X. So
it bugs me, and part of the reason that it bugs me is because like it never got broken from the OS 10 stuff, you mm-hmm. know, back in the day. You know, it's 10.14 now, and we still call it. It people like they're getting away from that by referring to everything by the code name, so that they don't mm-hmm. have to worry about is it OS X or OS 10. So. The thing that I don't like about it is that all of a sudden we've got all these weird naming conventions that we didn't have before. And I don't mind that they want to come up with their own naming conventions, but don't spend 10 years giving me naming conventions and then burn them all down. That's the part that I'm sort of frustrated about. Like the last time we got an iPhone that came in colors, it ended in C. It was the same phone, yeah, but color, but the backs were colored. So if you bought one that was a different color, it was the 5C instead of the 5. All the other stuff was the same.
It's a mnemonic device. It's a handy mnemonic device.
Right, that too. So I was like, oh, so this is the 10C. No, it's an R. We're not going to tell you why we called it R, because remember the S always used to stand for different stuff on the other phones. Like the S was for speed, and the S was for Siri, and the S was for other things. You know, they always said like this one is the S model because it's got this other thing. And yeah, this time they're like, it's R, and we're not going to tell you why. Like, it's just an R now, and we're going to call the other one 10S, and we're not going to have a 10S plus. We've conditioned you for years that the big phone is the plus, but no more. Like, now we're going to call it Max. But next year, like, are they going to have an iPhone 5, or does everything start with an X now? Like, all of the rest of them are going to be 10 models from here forward, yeah, and we're never going to get an iPhone 9. Like, I mean, we never really got an 8, because it's actually the 7S, even though they put it out of its misery today. The thing about it that I don't like is that on top of the naming convention being super confusing, now additionally, we have the fact that they're selling 7 different models, because they're still selling the 7 and the 8 and the 7 Plus and the 8 Plus, and now they've added the 10C and the new 10S and then the 10S Plus, even though that's not what they're calling them. So that takes us to 7 models of iPhone. So like when you walk in, it's going to be, you know, the dozen Android phones down one side and the dozen iPhones down the other side. And like that doesn't seem better to me.
Well, I think that's part of, I actually think that is part of what Apple has to do, is because they are one company serving. It's the same thing with Macs, where you have to kind of cover the gamut, is those Androids, a lot of them are by different manufacturers with different form factors. Now, Samsung does a lot of different form factors as far as, you know, how that goes. And so providing those is kind of giving that a community that doesn't have other choices, the theoretical choices that they want. I think Apple has to, you know, manage the fact that there are some people that are going to want an iPhone that aren't going to want to spend $750 on one, with the fact that that's all they really want you to buy, $750 and up. You know, like that's the, you know, they're being nice with the other ones, and those are very solid phones. I still use a 7, you know, as my international phone, and it's a great phone. So I think that you know, the price, that price dropping down, the new R is 95% the quality of, or maybe 90% the quality of last year's top of the line model for $250 less.
There was one story this year that resonated throughout all of our shows, not just Mac Break Weekly, but Twit and Security Now, and it's really something probably to be considered, I think, the story of the year 2018, still something of a mystery. It's Bloomberg's story about the Chinese chip hack. I asked the MacBreak Weekly panel what they thought of the story. Yeah, well, let's talk about privacy, because the big story of the week, and I would love to get your take on this, the big hack from Bloomberg Businessweek came out on Thursday, claiming that China put a tiny chip on motherboards coming from Supermicro that are used everywhere. We use them because they were Amazon discovered them before they bought the Elemental. They wanted to check security.
According to Bloomberg.
Again, everything we say will be according to Bloomberg Business Week. These elementals are everywhere, from the Mormon church to the Department of Defense.
I own 20 of them.
Yeah. Do you own any of the old Supermicro based? Because all of ours are, we traded that in for Amazon. I got
some older ones.
Bring in one and we'll take it apart. We'll see if we can find that chip. Seriously? Well, okay. So I'll complete the story. The next day, Amazon, Apple, the Chinese government all say BS. It didn't happen. Apple was very aggressive in its denial.
Apple, who barely ever answers press inquiries and answers them in the tersest way possible when it does answer them, put out pages of retort.
Yeah, and here's the letter they wrote to the members of Congress who inquired about it, the Energy Committee, the Commerce, Science, and Transportation Committee. We were struck by the fact that the gravity and magnitude of the claims seemed to be undermined by their uncertainty around key details. Nevertheless, we worked tirelessly to ascertain whether these claims were true, or failing that, if anything even like them was true. In the end, our internal investigations directly contradict every consequential assertion made in the article, some of which we note were based on a single anonymous source, although we should point out the article itself had 17 anonymous sources. Well, that doesn't surprise me, because if you knew this and you talked to Bloomberg Business Week, you're not going to give me your name, or you'd be in a small room in the Pentagon today.
This letter was signed by the head of InfoSec at Apple, which is unusual, too.
Yeah. I mean, so one thing some people claimed is maybe the Apple PR department didn't know, but this guy would for sure know. Apple's never found malicious chips.
And they had Bruce Sewell right. comment,
too. The thing is that for a publicly traded company to be so assertive puts themselves at incredible risk of lawsuits and SEC violations and everything else. For them to come out, and a publicly traded company to come out and say this, and have all of them say it, is they're risking a lot to say that.
Look at the Department of Homeland Security's Saturday announcement. We currently have no reason to doubt statements from companies that have denied this.
Throw that one away.
I don't throw it away, because to me, that's hedging.
If there were that many Supermicro things that were sent in, because this has to be part of a fab.
We will know sooner or later, because you and others have these elemental motherboards.
And I think that, but the thing is, if I was Bloomberg, I would have found that first.
They didn't find one.
Not a single. We're talking about thousands of processors, thousands of Supermicros that are floating around here with this infamous chip. But you've got to explain. I would not have created this. I would not have written this, or at least not published it, until I had a board.
But 17 sources is a lot of sources
when they're anonymous.
And this is Bloomberg Business Week is not. Fly-by-night operation.
I know, but
they've been working on this for a year.
And without someone coming on the record, I have this issue and no board.
No one is going to go on the record. You'd be in jail. I swear to God, no one's going to go on the record on this. No one is going to go on the record. What may happen, and what I hope will happen, and I expect will happen, is somebody who has one of these motherboards finds this chip. And by the way, this isn't
not that chip. That's the wrong chip.
This isn't the chip. That's another statement, by the way, by the one person who was quoted by name in it. A security researcher said, it doesn't smell right, because I talked to Jordan Robertson, one of the journalists who wrote this story. And a lot of the stuff that I told him was last year was regurgitated word for word. He said, this is a security expert named Joe Fitzpatrick said, I would never do it this way, frankly. A hardware implant's too easy to discover. It's much simpler just to do, firmware modifications and so forth.
He also said that he doesn't work for a nation state, and it would be highly unlikely a nation state would implement something that's the exact same way that he sort of off the cuff explained to a reporter how it might work.
Well, I don't find that convincing either. So... The question remains, is Bloomberg lying, Alex? Is that what you're saying? Or is it sloppy reporting?
I think it's sloppy reporting. I think that they're going to, this is going to damage their brand, and I think people are going to lose their jobs. You know, like it is not going to, because if it was true, they should have waited until they had evidence. You know, they should have waited until they had a board. If there's thousands of these boards around, I mean, if one of these boards exists, I bought Supermicros in the time frame that they're talking. Many
this is
of
2015.
Them.
So do you have some made Supermicro based elementals from 2014, 2015?
Absolutely.
Well, I think you owe us.
I'll bring one in.
I'll send it to iFixit.
I'll send an elemental.
iFix is pretty good at identifying chips.
Yep. With their scanners.
Or ChipWorks. Actually, it's ChipWorks that often does the work.
I actually have an elemental that I'm not very happy with. So, it's old. It's seen a lot of miles. We could send one to iFixit. If you give me somewhere to go, I'll send it out and they can look at it and see if they
can. Can you imagine if this is the Red Team 3 episode of the newsroom? Just played out.
It's hard to imagine the scenario here. Is possible that the U.S. government played Bloomberg? Because, of course, the U.S. government, which I might point out, is doing exactly this thing to others.
Everybody's doing it to everybody. But installing it onto the board is...
Well, you know where this... Okay, so I talked to somebody who knows a little bit about this. Where this sometimes, most often happens, is not in the Supermicro factory,
yep,
but after it's shipped. Mm-hmm. And the box goes through a depot in, Bethesda. Somebody opens the box, modifies the motherboard, and sends it on. That we know that happens. That actually has happened. We know that happens. It happens from us. It happens from China. It happens in many countries.
Israel.
We know that happens. Israel. We know that happens. So that's not a surprise. I mean, I guess the hot potato here is, did Supermicro do this themselves?
Yeah, the thing is that it's generally just not something you want to go back to the factory where it's going to assembler where it's going to go through a whole system of checks and everything else before it goes out. You want to do it after that when it's on the way, so you know where it's going, you know, and who you want to spy on, because sending it out too many places makes it easier to like putting it in the part that this seems very improbable is putting it into the manufacturing process. Just seems like if they put it into the manufacturing process, that is a lot of computers out there. I mean, Elemental didn't sell 10 of them.
That's the only thing
that
we're disputing, that you then disagree with. Not that it doesn't happen all the time, but that Supermicro got caught doing it. They're, by the way, they're based in San Jose. They're a U.S. company, although run by a Chinese national.
For me, the thing is the denials. I mean, like Apple and Amazon could conceivably have just said, look, we're looking into this. We don't know what's happened. There's no customer data that's been taken. We're going to report back to you. And it would have been fine. Like, it would have been annoying, but it would have been fine. We would have gotten over it and onto the next controversy by Tuesday. But it's the denials now. It's like, it's never the cover up. It's never the crime. It's always the cover up. To have Bloomberg double down on their sources and to have Apple and Amazon go so, I've never, ever seen these companies go so wholeheartedly on these denials. Any party in this could have de-escalated early on and saved a ton of face. Now there is so much at stake that you have to believe that there are a couple of people at Amazon and Apple that know this, that didn't even tell anybody who they would have to tell during the normal course of business at their company, including the IT and InfoSec chains and the legal chains. And it's just them sitting there talking to national security, and this one reporter happened to find out, or someone managed to bamboozle a reporter or steer them in the wrong way to the extent that Bloomberg was willing to publish this, and neither makes sense.
It have to be 17 someones, though.
But he might have 17 things saying, oftentimes you get info, like you can tell the quality of a journalist not by the sources they get, but by the narrative they extract from them. And seldom do reporters state facts. More often than not, reporters and their editors construct elaborate narratives around facts. And that's when they tend to make mistakes. It's not just reporting the things that they hear, it's trying to turn that into a story. And they've done something more often than not, we've seen that, especially with Apple. We've seen that with things like iPhone 10 sales, where you get a little bit of data and you make this whole iPhone 10 is not selling narrative turns out to be completely wrong. That is always a danger in journalism, and that's where there's potential exposure here.
We'll get right back to our holiday special in just a little bit. But before we go on, I do want to add one little thing, a gift you can give to us. We do this every once in a while. We have our yearly survey for you. And since our listeners are, we know, such techies, this year it's going to focus on how you use collaborative software at work, something we'd like to know. The survey's brief, shouldn't take you more than 6 minutes. We do not, and I really underscore this because it's important for me, and I know it's important for you, collect any personal data. All we ask is that you go to twit.to/survey12 for the 12th month, I guess. twit.to/survey12. And if you do that, great. You don't have to, but if you do it, it would be a nice gift for us, and it would help us a little bit in planning our future endeavors, if you know what I mean. And now, on with the show. Renee's got his review up. Almost all the best for way, way less. $250 less than an iPhone XS. $350 bucks less than a XS Max. But it sits right in the middle, right, size-wise.
Yeah, and Gruber did some math pointing out that you can get a 128 gigabyte version of the XR and not of the XS. So if you're just a little over 64 but don't want to pony up for the 256, you can save even more money just by going with the 128.
So they don't offer a 128 in the XS sizes.
Yeah. They go to 256 and then 512, which is like half a terabyte in your pocket.
Yeah, and I never – honestly, 64 is probably enough for everything I do. Most
it depends how much 4K and stuff like that that you shoot. So
yeah, and if you use the iCloud photo and if you don't put 100 books on there and your entire music library, 64 gigs is a huge
amount
of data. Your 19
Metallica original sound. I'm not pointing at Jim Dalrymple specifically, but some people like having all their music with them.
Some people want it all want to stream it. I understand that.
Nice hunk of glass.
Okay, show us. Let's see. So it is it is glass back.
Yes. The front glass is exactly the same as the iPhone XS. The back glass is somewhere in between the 10 and the 10S. It's stronger than the 10, not quite as strong as the 10S.
Now, some people said that the bezels were unsightly compared to the 10S.
They're not unsightly. They're just
bad
a little
me.
Bit bigger. Here, I turn on the flashlight somehow. That's great. Haptic touch to the rescue. There we go.
You can
so
see
they
them.
Are slightly bigger.
If you're coming, and it's an LCD, not an OLED, but if you're coming from an iPhone 6, 7, or 8, you're not going to notice that.
No, not at all. I mean, if I hold up one of these next to it, close. I keep getting beta things today, Leo. It's my beta day.
And one
so
of
if
the,
I hold up this next to it, like it's nothing of the same.
Yeah. You do get a notch.
There's a hard.
But yeah, I mean.
Yes.
And by the way, you're getting all of the internals of the XS.
It's rather interesting because Apple, according to Wall Street, Apple's only job is to sell more iPhones or to sell more expensive iPhones. And they've been doing that with the Plus and with the 10 line. They've been really raising average sales prices. And now with the 10R, I mean, some people are likening it to the iPhone 5C, but that did not have Touch ID. It had the previous generation processor. It really was an iPhone 5, not an iPhone 5S. The iPhone XR is an iPhone 10. It has the same processor, same true depth camera, same wide angle camera on the back. It is much closer to an iPhone XS than it is an iPhone X. And that could, $250 cheaper, that could really skew Apple's ASPs down again, which would not make Wall Street happy. But Apple really wants to take the technology that they have in the 10 line and make it accessible to more people. They have this annoying habit that Wall Street hates, which is to try to grow rather than just monetize. And I think it's good long-term thinking, but I think it'll get them yelled at short-term.
Yeah, bravo, and screw Wall Street, because I don't think Wall Street's got their best interests at heart. They just want to cash in as quick as they can.
It's still a $750 phone.
It's
but
not cheap.
That's it. But that said, it's a very, very pleasant sign that Apple has consistently tried to do this. We feel as though we have a list of price levels that our customers are comfortable with. However, that said, we are going to continue to try to take the features of the higher end phones and bring them into the lower price points. Yeah. So the fact that they decided not to make the iPhone X into a luxury brand, that's here's the $1,000 and up phone always, but simply to say we're going to use this to drop into the one end of this pipeline features that in a year or two's time is going to be in the mainstream $750 phone. That's really, really great.
What, Renee, is missing? What don't you get?
So you don't get the well. That's not missing. That's gone from all of them.
Long gone. Handy.
You don't get the OLED display. You get an LCD display. Apple says it's their best LCD ever. I find it like they're so good at color calibration and color matching. It is you know, it's traditional iPhone DPI, the same DPI they've had since the iPhone 4, the same DPI they had on the iPhone 8. But you, like in daily use, you really can tell. It doesn't do the inky blacks of OLED and doesn't have the extreme contrast of OLED. So Apple's not advertising it as an HDR panel, even though some LCD TVs say, well, we go brighter, so that counts as HDR. Right. Apple doesn't want to play that game, so they say it's not. Like, it'll play HDR 10 and HDR and Dolby Vision content, but it will split, it'll do the best job it can, but they're not claiming that it's HDR. So you're missing the panel, and then you're missing the telephoto lens on the back. So you have the exact same wide angle lens as the iPhone XS, 30% larger with deeper and bigger pixels and the HDR, the smart HDR feature, but you don't have that 2.4 aperture telephoto lens.
Yeah.
So no 2x optical zoom and no real depth data like you'd get off the true depth camera, sorry, off the dual camera system on an iPhone 10. They do something very similar to the Google Pixel, which is they use the parallax data from the phase adjust focus system, what Apple calls focus pixels, and they mix that with a segmentation mask. The thing that's really interesting, though, the thing that I spent most of my time asking about and looking into is that Apple had their camera teams go and get a bunch of high-end lenses and cameras, which I'm sure they hated to do, and just shoot the crap out of them and then build up a model, a physical model of what an iPhone lens could be. And it's different between the iPhone XS because that's the telephoto and the iPhone XR because they did it for the wide angle. So taking the same shots, they didn't want to have a perfect sanitized computational lens. They wanted it to be quirky and have a personality, like a real world lens. So the bokeh is not just a disc blur that's layered on top. There's not just like a smooth fill over the back. There's, it actually renders on the silicon this entire world that as much as a computer vision can understand, and like overlapping lights and distortion around the outside, it, like you'd get with a real lens. And it just, it's hard to describe it, but when you look at what it used to do and what it does now, or what some other phones do, they really do just apply a Gaussian or a disc blur. It's like night and day. It's really, really cool technology.
The other reason people might want it is it's one of those size things. It might be just right. Here's a great image that you took comparing the iPhone X on the left, the iPhone XR on the right, or rather the XS on the left, iPhone XR on the right, and the XS Max on the far right. The middle one is let me start over. In order from left to right, the XS, the XR, and the XS Max. So it's between the two, right?
Yeah, because of the bezels, it's probably closer to the 10, to the Max than it is to the regular size one. But it feels in between. I actually do like it better because I found the Max just a little bit big for me. I was a huge iPhone Plus fan.
Yeah, a lot of people are saying the XS Max is just too big, but I want more than the XS. This is right there, right?
And it has all the features that the XS has that I wish the Max has that I wish the XS has, like display zoom. And when you rotate it sideways, it has a split view controller.
Oh, interesting.
So I really like all that.
Okay. So now I'm presuming you're going to keep your XS Max as your real phone or not.
I ordered the XS Max, but I think George is probably going to just rob me of that, and I'll end up getting a XS because I know a lot of people are saying they're going to go with the XR, that they think it's a much better phone. I really, really like the camera system on the XS. I shoot in 2X all the time, and I like the OLED screen because I'm a complete nerd over HDR. So for me, it's worth the extra $250 to get those two features. I think I'm the exception, not the rule, though, and I think most people will be super happy with the XR.
Let's talk iPad, baby.
Hang on, I'll switch from my wired headphones to Bluetooth for this section.
But only if Renee, if only Renee had an iPad to show us, or Andy. They've got to have an iPad laying around.
Let's see.
No.
There's the folio case. He's got the folio case.
Yeah, these keys, by the way, are like bubble wrap for me. I can't stop. This is like my worst change because I can't stop pressing them like bubble wrap.
I like them. All right.
Here, let me turn this bad boy around. Here we go. This is a 12.9.
See, this is what I was really interested in. I had the old 12.9. It was just too big. But now what they've done is the same size screen with a smaller form factor. I feel like that might be the one to get.
It's, people thought it was the 11 inch, and they're like, "What is the 12.9 look like?" They were like, "That is the 12.9."
And wait till you hold it. I was surprised. Like after the demo area, I went to look at the specs. I was surprised to find out that the new 12.9 inch is not that much lighter than the old one. It felt so much lighter in my hands because it just feels so much smaller because it is so much smaller. So it's quite a nice piece of kit.
They pulled that trick that I forget, was it Google or Microsoft who said that you could balance it on your finger because they arrayed everything around it. So I was doing that at the thing and it made them very nervous.
You can do that?
You can it's going to take me a second to get my finger in the middle.
But
it's
actually handy for sushi. You could put it right on the surface there, that glass surface.
I'm going to totally drop my iPad now.
Please don't.
You can just totally.
Look at that.
See, he's got his finger
on the Apple. And see, that's the kind of real attention to detail I love Apple for.
Well, it makes it feel lighter because the balance is distributed nicely.
That makes a huge difference.
Just like a magazine or a pad of paper also balances around the center. So that's such an important little detail.
Wow. Yeah, you don't want it to be heavy in one end. And it's kind of the thing you might not notice, but you will subconsciously. Yeah. I do have to say the lack of a headphone jack baffles me. I just don't understand. I asked about that. We didn't see it coming, did we?
It was a surprise. I mean, they've got headphones everywhere.
They were happily showing the schematics where, like, they're you'd have to make it because the liquid retina goes past what you would see where the bezels are. Like, it goes inside there to house it. So there's no room in those bezels. You'd have to make it thick enough to put it underneath the display. And they didn't want to do that. They didn't want to add a Han Solo box like the Millennium Falcon.
They have a camera bump for crying out loud.
That's what I'm going to say. I mean, it's okay for them to say we have lots of decisions to make. We decided that we didn't want to put a headphone jack in there. The only thing that I would do, that I really, really gets my hackles up is if they were to say, well, we had no choice. Our hands were tied. Well, no, you could have done it if you wanted to. You just didn't want to. And I do think that on an iPad Pro, that's a dumb move. I do think that's dumb.
Well, fortunately, it has a Type-C port, and I can use my Pixel 3 headphones. And the battery is long enough. So what do you think? The Type-C, it can do anything Type-C can do except external storage.
It can do external storage. It's just that iOS and the Files app has no concept of external storage, so you have to get an app that understands external storage, and then you can plug it in, and you're fine.
It doesn't have a driver. If you plug it in as is, it'll think it's a camera, basically.
And you got to think that that's a glaring hole that Apple's going to fill with iOS 13.
They could easily.
And I think that over the next 6 to 8 months, it's going to be explosive watching what happens with that USB-C.
There'll be a Riattle app that'll let you plug in a drive within 3 seconds, I bet.
Yeah. Could I plug in a keyboard and mouse now? No.
No, it has no – a keyboard, I don't know. Like the Bluetooth is still for that, but it has no concept of a – like iOS itself.
Doesn't know
beyond beyond the insertion pointer on the trackpad mode, it doesn't understand it. They would have to add something like Focus UI, which is what lets you choose on an Apple TV which icon you're on. They actually have to build out a system because iOS was designed for the iPhone, and that's like – the iPad is hobbled by a lot of early decisions for the iPhone when they didn't really foresee – what it was going to be now. And that's another one of those things that they're going to have to go through. You can't just drag and drop Mac on because that's terrible. They have to actually architect it for iPad.
But that really shouldn't affect how it works with USB keyboard, right? Because you can plug in a USB keyboard into the Lightning port with the adapter. Okay, just want to make sure.
Yeah.
So, I think Nilay Patel's Verge article for me was pretty right on, in which he says, look, you can't deny it. This is amazing hardware. As Apple pointed out, the curved screen corners, in every respect, the super fast 12X Bionic. But without it, it's hard to edit text unless you have a mouse.
Yeah.
You can't do it with your finger very well. And no trackpad, no mouse. And the software today for iOS isn't really desktop quality, the lack of a file system. You could fix that, I guess. It's a lot of promise, but I'm going to try anyway to use it as my main system, but I have a feeling I'll have the same reaction Nilay does.
Yeah, I just think that it's just like with the day one of the first version of the iPad, I don't think you can judge it as a laptop or as a laptop replacement. You have to think about it as the things you there are things that you do with your laptop, yeah. And can you do those same things with this device? And sometimes, in a lot of cases, the answer is going to be no, particularly if it involves I've got arbitrary file X on arbitrary file storage device Y. I just need to get this damn thing visible to this file system. That's going to be a complete fail. However, when you look at the caliber of mobile of productivity apps that have been designed for the iPad, and yes, we're talking about art apps. Yes, we're talking about drawing apps, but we're also talking about things like Scrivener by Literature and Latte. It's a really hardcore book-length writing tool that is one of the most brilliant translations of a desktop app to mobile to a tablet I've ever seen. I really don't think that Windows has got there quite yet in terms of taking an app that works great on a big screen and making it work as well in that context of a smaller screen. I've been using a Chromebook for the past couple of weeks, particularly since my MacBook died, and it does many things very, very well, but not at the same level of polish. And then beyond that, you do get the ability to use this pencil in a way that's not, oh, isn't it great? You're taking notes when you're handwriting notes and you're doing little sketches and doodles. No, with the iPad Pro, you really can do professional caliber artwork with it, and people do. So I don't, I agree with the broad strokes of that argument. If you're buying this, if you've got $1,000 or $1,300 for a new laptop and you buy an iPad Pro instead, you are going to be let down. However, if you have $1,200 for a mobile answer to, I need to do X, Y, Z, double X, double Y, double Z, and you find the solutions for the iPad, I don't think you'll be terribly disappointed at all.
Well, here we are at the end of 2018. It's been a great year from Apple's point of view. New Macintosh computers, new iPads, new iPhones. I hope we've been able to tell you a little bit about what to expect, to understand a little bit better about what Apple's up to. And we hope to do a lot more in 2019 with the wonderful Andy Iannocco from Boston Public Radio, Renee Ritchie from iMore.com, Alex Lindsay from the Pixel Corps, and of course our cast of regulars like Jason Snell and Adam Angst. Really, you're a big part of the cast of this show, too. We're so glad you watch. I hope you will watch every week next week. I hope you'll subscribe. We'll be back next week, actually, is New Year's Day, so I don't think... I'm still probably going to be hungover, so I don't think I'll be there. But we'll do something. Maybe a repeat of this. Happy New Year, everybody! If you're watching on New Year's Day, and then January 8th, we'll be back with all new Mac Break Weeklies at our regular time, 11 a.m. Pacific, 2 p.m. Eastern. That is 1900 UTC on Tuesdays. I hope you'll tune in each and every week. And as we wrap up this holiday season, I wish you and yours the most wonderful Christmas and New Year and Hanukkah, whatever you celebrate, and all the best for 2019. Let's have some peace in the year and some happiness and cheers. Thanks for watching us. And now, I'm sad to say, break time's over. Time to get back to the eggnog. Merry Christmas, everybody.